Hello everyone, welcome to Melbourne City Council. It is our Future Melbourne Committee number 8 on Tuesday the 13th of April 2021. We're kicking off at 5:30 p.m. Lovely to see everybody and thank you for joining us. The City of Melbourne respectfully acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which the City of Melbourne is gathered, the Bunurong Boonwurrung and the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung peoples of the Eastern Kulin Nation, and we pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging. The City of Melbourne is absolutely committed to our reconciliation journey, and we believe that every effort we can make to strengthen relationships between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal peoples has benefits for us as individuals, as a community, a city and a state. As part of our efforts to contain the spread of COVID-19 and pursuant to the provisions of Sections 394 and 395 of the Local Government Act 2020, the Council and committee meetings will be held virtually until further notice. During the period 1 May 2020 to 26 April 2022, councils do not need to provide for members of the public to physically attend meetings. Providing public access via live streaming services satisfies the public attendance test during this prescribed period. This meeting is now being streamed live, and the audio and video recording will be published on the council's website by close of business tomorrow. The unconfirmed minutes of this meeting will also be provided on the Council's website as soon as practicable. Can I ask at this point that all mobile phones please be turned to silent or off for the duration of the meeting? The agenda this evening comprises 7 reports from management. No apologies have been received. I advise members of the committee and the public that where the committee makes a decision on the basis of fewer than 6 members voting in favour of it, the decision may be referred by a councillor to council for decision. Conflicts of interest. Councillors, if anybody has either a general or material conflict of interest as defined in the Local Government Act 2020 in relation to a matter to be considered this evening, please advise the type and nature of your conflict at the time that that item is being considered. Thank you. It's now time for us to consider the minutes of the previous meeting. I am calling on a councillor to move a resolution. Oh dear, sorry. I'm calling on a councillor to move a resolution adopting the minutes of open meeting number 7 held on Tuesday, 16 March 2021. Councillor Chang, thank you. Councillor Campbell is seconding that motion. I'm putting the motion to the vote. All those in favour, please raise your hands. It's unanimous. I declare the motion carried. A terrible time to get a tickle in my throat. Apologies. Councillors, are there any matters arising from those minutes that you would like to discuss at this time? No? Good, thank you. The following submissions have been received in accordance with the Council's governance rules. In relation to Agenda Item 6.1, which is Planning Permit Application TP-2020-89 Queen Victoria Market, open bracket, Trader Shed, close bracket, which is 16-94 Peel Street, Melbourne. We've had requests to speak from Alexander Douthwaite, Heather Lawrence, Jane Stanley, Charles Solwine, Heritage Committee Chair, Royal Historical Society of Victoria, Mary Lou Howie, President, Friends of Queen Victoria Market, Leah Moore, Tristan Davies, Melbourne Heritage Action, Miriam Fain, Friends of Queen Victoria Market, Tony Ansaldo, Frank Fontana, Daniel Sussan and Mia Zahr from Tract Consultants. Council has received 26 items of correspondence in relation to this agenda item. In relation to agenda item 6.2, planning permit application, TP-2020-101, Queen Victoria Market, open bracket, Northern Shed, close bracket, 16 to 94 Peel Street, Melbourne. We've had requests to speak from Heather Lawrence, Jane Stanley, Charles Sorrowine, Heritage Committee Chair, Royal Historic Society of Victoria, Mary Lou Howie, President, Friends of Queen Victoria Market, Leah Moore, Miriam Fain, Friends of Queen Victoria Market, and Daniel Sisson and Mia Zahr from Track Consultants. We've had 24 items of correspondence in relation to that item. In relation to agenda item 6.3, planning permit application TP-2020-570, which is 165 to 167 Exhibition Street, Melbourne, we've had a request to speak from Dennis Leviny, Tristan Davies, Lucas Paterno. We've had items of correspondence from Dennis Leviny, Tristan Davies, and Lucas Paterno. In relation to agenda item 6.4, plans endorsement, ID-2020-2, Icon Park redevelopment, Princess Park, Carlton. We've had requests to speak from Kane Little, CEO, Carlton Football Club, Chris Townshend, board member of Carlton Football Club, and Vaughan Connor from Contour Town Planning. We've had items of correspondence from Chris Thrum and Michael Henderson from Contour Town Planning. In relation to agenda item 6.6, which is Queen Victoria Market Precinct Renewal Food Court Concept Design, we've had requests to speak from Vijay Sivaraj and Leah Moore. We've had items of correspondence from Vijay Sivaraj, Joe Vitale, Leah Moore, Stan Liakis, Cynthia Lim and Michael Nelthorpe. Thank you very much to everybody who has provided a submission, either written or is providing a verbal submission this evening. Thank you for participating. I'm advising submitters who have asked to speak this evening that we will call on you for your presentation at the time that the item is considered. You will have 3 minutes to address the committee. Given the number of speakers this evening, it is our intention to keep you to those 3 minutes. To assist you, there is a countdown timer. A bell will ring when 2 minutes are complete, just to give you the 1 minute warning, and it will ring again at the end of the 3 minutes. If you could please finalise your submission at that time, it would be greatly appreciated. And there's the sound of the bell that you will hear. Thank you. It is part of our Future Melbourne Committee that we have time for public questions, and we allow, in accordance with our governance rules, a 15-minute period at the start and at the end of each meeting. To enable the public to fully participate in Future Melbourne Committee meetings, members of the public can submit a question in writing, or they can register to ask a question via our audio link. There have been 6 written questions received for tonight's meeting. I note that in reading out the questions, I'm not attesting at all to the veracity or factual nature of those statements made. I'm reading them verbatim. I'm going to just keep an eye on the time, but we have received 4 questions all on a similar matter, which is horse-drawn carriages. And so I'm going to read out all of the questions and then I'm going to provide a response. The first question is from Kristen Lee, campaign manager for Melbourne Against Horse-Drawn Carriages. Kristen writes, "We are currently gathered outside this meeting as Melbourne Against Horse-Drawn Carriages, representing the people of Melbourne and in fact the world, who have had enough of seeing horses used as vehicles on our roads, endangering cyclists, pedestrians, other commuters, and the horses themselves. Tourists contact us frequently explaining that they will not visit this city as seeing the horses used this way is too upsetting. Cyclists contact us frequently reporting how their lives have been endangered by being forced out of their bike lanes and into traffic. Other commuters contact us frequently with stories of being endangered by the carriages, through horses spooking and bolting out of control through city streets, or the operators themselves being abusive and threatening toward them. Just last month, images flashed across the global media of yet again a horse laying on the road, but this time the horse wasn't severely injured or in pain or being kicked and abused by the operator or being hit by a tram with a gash across its face. This time the horse was dead. The regulations imposed on carriage operators prior to July 2017 proved to be ineffective. The ban on street trading in 2017 has also proven to be ineffective. The City of Melbourne has proven they cannot manage this situation as it is impossible to be managed. The dangers and cruelty are inherent in the trade. Will you finally request support from the state government to have horse-drawn carriages banned from the entire City of Melbourne precinct, or will you wait for someone else to be killed, quite possibly a human? The second question is from Alana Bacon, who says, I am at a loss to understand how horse-drawn carriages continue to flout the laws in the CBD without consequence. Illegal U-turns, illegal parking, illegal street trading, using bike lanes, etc. I can only conclude that these operators are not being fined, and if they are, they are refusing to pay. Otherwise, if there was a blitz on their serial law breaking, it would not be viable for them to enter the city at all. Somebody is not doing their job. I believe they are classed as vehicles. This being the case, your negotiation with Vic Roads, knowing the dangers these vehicles pose, should be more than sufficient to rid the CBD of their presence before the next tragedy involving the death of another horse or quite possibly a human being. So who is not doing their job? The City of Melbourne, the Victorian Police, or the state government? The next question is from Elizabeth Viggers, who says, I regularly cycle to work through the city and have had many encounters with horse-drawn carriages taking over bicycle lanes. Like other cyclists, I feel vulnerable when pushed into traffic in order to bypass the horses. It is particularly dangerous at night when we are less visible to drivers. Recently, on my way home from work, I was forced into general traffic due to a horse-drawn carriage fully occupying the bicycle lane, also a no-standing zone. I was almost hit by a bus. I called the council and reported the incident, but I am unsure if anything was done. However, if a car had been parked in a bicycle lane or a no-standing zone, then I'm sure that they would at least have received a fine. The incident was certainly not an isolated event. I am certain that eventually there will be more serious injuries or deaths as a result of horse-drawn carriage operators mixing with cars, trams, pedestrians, and bicycles. I understand that police and state government are responsible for enforcing road safety laws, but when this trade continues due to the City of Melbourne being unable or unwilling to enforce local street trading and parking laws, there is a responsibility that lays with you. So my question is, when is the City of Melbourne going to take this safety risk seriously? The fourth question is from Rita Couchy. Rita says, I am a 66-year-old woman, and approximately 3 to 4 years ago, I was quietly standing in Swanston Street, Melbourne, holding up a poster outlining the City of Melbourne's bylaws on carriage rides, when I had the poster literally and violently torn from my hands by a carriage driver who then shredded the poster and stuffed it into a bin. I was extremely fearful as his aggression was palpable, but when I went to the nearest police station to report the theft and assault, I was literally laughed at by the police officer on the front desk, and then, quite unbelievably, he refused to take my statement. He continued to laugh at me when I stated that he was legally obliged to take a statement from me. My question to the council is, although it may not be the City of Melbourne's responsibility to deal with violent abuse Your inability to enforce the ban on street trading and illegal parking has allowed this trade to continue and given confidence to both carriage drivers and law enforcement officers that they can flout the law and not be punished for their actions. Why is the City of Melbourne allowing these carriage drivers to make a mockery of its own bylaws, and what exactly are the role of bylaws if the law refuses to enforce them? The following response has been prepared by our on-street support and compliance lead, Dean Robertson. And it states, horse-drawn vehicles are classified as a vehicle under the Road Safety Road Rules. Local laws officers are tasked and do proactively monitor horse-drawn vehicles for compliance in relation to parking restrictions and illegal street trading. In relation to parking infringements, many have been issued and most are either before the court as the operator is challenging the infringement or they are with Fines Victoria for collection. Operators of horse-drawn vehicles can and do take bookings online and make arrangements with the customer to collect them at a designated pickup point. This is not street trading, as the booking was pre-arranged. Local laws officers monitor horse-drawn vehicle operators for street trading, but often there is not enough evidence to issue an infringement. Moving violations such as driving in a bike lane, moving through tram stops, accessing Swanston Street without a permit fall to Victoria Police to observe and to act. City of Melbourne is working with Victoria Police to improve detection of the horse-drawn vehicles moving in or through parts of roads in breach of the Road Safety Road Rules. It is expected this work will be complete by the 30th of June 2021 and ongoing enforcement will commence after this date. Thank you for your questions. I'm now reading a written question we've received from Andrew Turner. Andrew says, I wish to ask the following questions about the Carlton Recreation Ground and MCC administration. Question number one, the plans show match day entry from Royal Parade side. Will there be an entry from other points? Number two, what parking arrangements have been agreed with Carlton Football Club? Number three, will there be parking ingress egress from the eastern side? Number four, is parking capacity in Princess Park to be increased? Number five, has Yarra City been consulted about parking on event days? Number six, what verification will Melbourne City Council make on event days that the lighting specifications in C377 Carlton Recreation Ground are being adhered to? Number seven, what limitations will MCC place on the number of events per week, per month, per year? And that was the total, seven questions in total, Andrew, and your questions were considered and responded to by Larry Parsons, who is a practice leader in our land use and development team. And it says this, the requirements as set out in the incorporated documents were set by the Minister for Planning, not by Council. Council's role is limited to endorsing documentation to satisfy these approved requirements. In response to your questions, in terms of number one, the primary entry point to the site will remain as Royal Parade. Existing secondary entries around the ground will not be altered. Question number two, car parking does not form part of this application and existing parking facilities will not be altered. The Council's considerations only include those matters within the special controls overlay area. This includes new buildings, not parking. The capacity of the ground will be reduced to 22,000 people. Question three, no new parking is being provided. The existing car park to the west of the ground will be maintained. No new car parking and car parking entries will be provided east of the ground. Number four, parking capacity will not be increased. Number five, no event information has yet been provided. event day information, I should say, has been provided. The incorporated document approved by the Minister for Planning does not require consultations with Yarra City Council if events are held at the ground. Traffic management issues will be assessed by the City of Melbourne in accordance with the conditions of the incorporated document. Number six, all lighting will be operated in accordance with the lighting specification plan and broadcast lighting management plan to be considered by the committee. If third parties consider lighting on event days does not comply with these plans, planning enforcement will then investigate those claims. And number seven, the ID, which is the incorporated document, requires the submission of an event management plan ahead of all qualifying events, and those are events in excess of 7,500 people. This plan would set out the patron numbers, patron management and car parking measures. The relevant condition of the incorporated document does not limit the number of non-football events that can be held on the site. Andrew, thank you. I note that you have said that there was no public consultation on this proposal and that you would like those questions and answers provided in writing, and we will send those through to you. Thank you for your question. There is another question, but I will leave that to the 15 minutes at the end of the meeting. And that means that we can get underway with reports from management, and I'm calling on Deputy Lord Mayor Councillor Rees to assume the role of chair of this meeting in relation to the city planning portfolio. Over to you, Deputy Lord Mayor. Thank you.
Thank you, Lord Mayor, and thank you for soldiering on with a croaky voice there at some points. There are four reports from management for consideration under the planning portfolio this evening. The first of those is agenda item 6.1, planning permit application TP-20-89, Queen Victoria Market, Trader Shed, 16 to 94 Peel Street, Melbourne. I need to ask if any councillors need to declare a conflict on this item. I'm looking around and confirming the answer to that is no. And I'm also going to request that councillors receive a presentation on this item because we do know that there is quite a bit of community interest. So I would call on Larry Parsons, Practice Leader, Land Use and Development, to make a brief presentation to us this evening. Thank you, Larry.
Thank you, Deputy Lord Mayor. Next slide, please. That's the whole market area. Next slide, please. We're talking about the existing trader shed and public toilets between the meat hall and shed H. That what you see there in that boxy shape was the original application. Next, this is after it was modified. The process is that it's on the Heritage Register. So Heritage Victoria gives a permit for all heritage matters, and they have required, as you can see there, a gable roof form and a change of materials to emphasise brick. And the doors is obviously for the loading area. Next, please. That is the demolition of the existing G shed. Next, and toilets. The site has four basements, mostly for storage. You will see the orange area on the top basement is new public toilets, increased in size and facilities. Next. The ground floor, the blue area, is obviously the loading and unloading from Queen Street to the far left. And then we have at the rear a plaza area and the entry to the public toilets and to the upper floors, that sort of orange-coloured area. Next. This is traders' toilet and dressing facilities on the first floor. At the front, you're still seeing the extra height of the loading area. Next. And finally, at the front is inside of the roof form plant. And to the rear, the blue area is a trader meeting and sort of a recreation area. Next, and that's the roof form where you'll see the gable pointing towards Queen Street. Next. The two changes. The top was the original application and below the Heritage Victoria amended application, which we are conditioning in the planning permit. Next. The side elevation showing the same, the bottom being the conditioned response with the brick and the roof form. Next. and that is just the side elevation you don't really appreciate to the meat hall, where there's a glazed roof over the passageway. Next, and the rear, where you'll see once again the lower is the Heritage Victoria approved scheme, which has brick. So basically, we're incorporating all the conditions imposed by Heritage Victoria. Our traffic engineers have reviewed and are accepting of the loading and unloading access. And that, I think, is the last slide. Next, please. That was it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that, Larry. Are there any questions for Larry on this particular agenda? We'll be asking you, I think, to present shortly on the next agenda item. I can see that there are no questions, so I might move on to questions. We do have a couple of people who have requested to present to us this evening. I would remind our presenters that we are here this evening to consider a planning permit application. We're not here to debate the merits of this proposal or the benefits of it one way or another to the operations of the Queen Victoria Market. All the opinions of traders, the community or others, we're here to perform the fairly narrow task of deciding whether or not the proposal before us complies with the Melbourne Planning Scheme, relevant heritage policies, the City of Melbourne policies around traffic and other factors. So I would humbly request that presenters please try to speak to the matter that is before the city tonight, that is the planning permit application. On that note, I will call on Alexander Douthwaite, who requested the opportunity to address the committee in relation to this matter, and I ask Alexander to please speak for no more than 3 minutes.
Good evening, Chair. Alexander wasn't able to join us tonight, so we can move on to the next submitter.
Okay, thank you. I'll move on to Heather Lawrence to speak for no more than 3 minutes.
Heather, you may need to accept the unmute request.
Okay, I'm unmuted. Well, I'm just wanting to say I'm a little confused. I am not speaking directly to the application. I'm wanting to address a wider issue about the question of renewal and its effects in general on the community of traders and the community post-COVID. So if you're saying I can't speak about that, then I'm not sure why I was allowed to.
Heather, we welcome your comments. You have 3 minutes. Just making the observation that in terms of what councillors are going to decide upon tonight, they're going to decide on whether or not the application before us complies with relevant planning code and regulations.
Yes. Okay. I understand now. All right. Well, in fact, I have come as a general merchandise trader to express some ideas for a rethink of the term renewal. And I'm addressing in particular all of the strategic plans for the QVM as they existed in, as they exist now, but were developed 6-7 years ago. So what we see in these plans is a rollout of that. I want to express my deep concerns about the blind spots, as I see it, in these moments post-COVID for what renewal means in to the QVM and to the traders in particular and the community. All the documents since the time of development have stayed the same, and that is there's an emphasis on the infrastructure, the buildings and everything else. And it appears that from the point of view of leadership management in the QVM, that there isn't any responsibility to think about the wider picture of traders apart from rent reduction. And I'm concerned about that. So I'm wanting the Future Melbourne to think, what does renewal mean now? What does renewal mean for traders within who are a community of traders who have stuck by right throughout the COVID time? Some of us unable to trade all of that time, and what might it mean for us in the bigger picture of the role of the Queen Victoria Market in terms of its social impact in the community. And I note that City of Melbourne is very committed to social impact, and I put the idea that the QVM could be a centre, a real light for social impact and entrepreneurship. This comes from my view of the stories, the contemporary stories of traders there now, not just the history. Many of the people there now, not only 40 and 50 years on, but those and intergenerational, but those who have come even a few years before COVID came along, with incredible stories of fortitude and entrepreneurship and courage to continue on. One trader said to me, and he's been there for a long time, I'm coming along, I lose money every day, but when I needed to come, when I first arrived in this country, the Queen Victoria Market gave me a place to earn a living, so I'm staying here for them now. And I have those in my mind as I speak to the traders every day. And I've found out several things that were very disturbing. I found out that some traders didn't know how to access the City of Melbourne grants, so they missed out on those opportunities.
Heather, I'm going to have to ask you to conclude. Thank you very much for your contribution this evening. We do appreciate it. I now call on Jane Stanley to speak for no more than 3 minutes.
Hello, can you hear me?
You can indeed. Welcome to Town Hall virtually, Jane.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to address Council. I just want to introduce myself. I work as a consultant to the UN looking at markets overseas, particularly in the Pacific region. And I've been producing some manuals on best practices for managing and improving markets and running markets as a business. And I want to address the social and economic impacts of the proposal. I previously looked at the business plan for the improvements and I commented on those and my comments still stand. There does not seem to have been an impact assessment that's looked at employment with all the data, and I note some recent comments that the improvements are going to produce 400 short-term jobs. My calculations based on data when I've used it for other markets is you're looking at probably 6,000 long-term jobs that might be affected by this proposal. And I work with local governments that manage markets in other places, some of them many times larger than Queen Victoria Market. It is quite common for local government not to know what it's got in terms of an economic powerhouse of the market, in terms of the economic multiplier and the jobs multiplier. So my estimate is just multiplying up from Preston Market, where I've got some data, is that your market is probably worth about $300 million a year to the local economy. But council should be doing those sorts of assessments. And I haven't seen anything that informs councillors about what the economics and the jobs are that are threatened by development. And any development is going to have an impact. It may be beneficial, but if you're going to look at short-term job gains, you should look at long-term jobs and how to protect them. The manuals that I've been developing based on case studies all over the place shows that a lot of improvements are actually counterproductive and traders earn less than they did before. In some cases, traders refuse to move into the new markets. And there are some very good examples of where if traders who are the experts in how a market runs, if they are involved in the market development process and agree to it, you can get very good outcomes, both for the traders and for the local government. Local government should be making far more money out of this market than they are, if I look at other models overseas. So I would urge that the council does a proper social and economic assessment, but also maybe reviews how it's working with the traders so that you can get a really collaborative design that's agreed to everybody by everybody. If you want to look at a case study of how it didn't work and now with a more collaborative process, how it's ended up with a real exemplar market, go to Lautoka in Fiji. which is about three times as big as Queen Victoria Market. The traders actually closed the town down at one stage because they were so cross about the improvement proposals, and it's now one of the best functioning markets in the region. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane, for your submission. And I will remind speakers, we have quite a few people to hear from this evening, so we'll be enforcing the 3 minutes quite strictly. I now call on Charles Sowerween, who is a Heritage Committee Chair of the Royal Historic Society of Victoria. Welcome to Town Hall, Charles.
Hello, can you hear me?
We can hear you loud and clear.
Thank you for the opportunity to address this meeting, Lord Mayor, councillors. I'd note that the point has been made, we're not to debate the merits of the whole proposal, but rather the town planning aspects. But following the excellent points Jane Stanley's just made, I'd call on you to consider the fact that you are tonight debating the key aspects of this renewal, which, as people have said, basically aims to fulfill the original plan of Robert Doyle, and would revolutionize the market in ways that I think and we believe will be very harmful to it in the medium term. If you aren't going to discuss those tonight, when are you going to discuss them? When are you going to pause and review the situation? With Trader's Shed itself, the design is certainly much less problematic now that the improvements have been made thanks to Heritage Victoria to insert it more within the rhythms and building envelopes characteristic of the Queen Victoria Market, though I would still point out that the Trader's Shed as designed remains a fairly heavy and despite the more gabled roof profile, a rather squarish building in the context of the rounded arches of the meat market and the gabled roofs, the very light gabled roofs of the sheds. I think that you could go back to square one and redesign a much more lighter building, and I think that should be considered. But I want to submit to you tonight, and I'll return to this in the context of the northern shed, that you are actually very near the last steps in approving a proposal which is basically problematic for the direction it would take the market, for the complete change in the way the market operates that it would engineer. Thank you.
Thank you, Charles. I now call on Mary Lou Howie, President of Friends of Queen Victoria Market, to speak for no more than 3 minutes. Welcome back to Town Hall, Mary Lou.
Oh, thank you, Councillor Rees. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Thank you, Lord Mayor and councillors. Superficially, the council planning applications before you tonight claim a substantial rethink for the future of QVM. However, this is not the case, and I feel is misleading the public. On close inspection, not a rethink at all, but a relocation of the same old plan, the QVM Precinct Master Plan of 2014, from a pre-COVID world. On scrutiny, city designers show themselves as neatniks, completely uninformed about how a working market operates, and they've come up with a logistical nightmare that is potentially dangerous to the trading community. The new plans are supposedly driven by OH&S to eliminate forklift traffic around the market and improve operations, but in reality, they just rationalise an architectural or some other obscure objective. The forklift usage can and should be managed, as I've pointed out in my written submission, referencing OH&S expert Dr. Jerry Ayres, who advises the CFMEU and others in this regard. Operations and infrastructure should work together. The knowledge and solutions dovetailing both are already in the market, having evolved in the trader community through years of practice. Building on that, rather than relying on the theories of town planners and bureaucrats, is the answer to a workable, less obstructive, and far less expensive outcome. People do not come to Vic Mark in search of a brighter, lighter, cleaner, greener, and more pleasant environment, yet subtly contemporary. I quote your words. Our heritage market has a distinctive, unique character and a reputation that's valued exactly for what it is now. The Borough Charter, as adopted by the Australian Heritage Council, says, advocate a cautious approach to change. do as much as necessary to care for the place and to make it usable, but otherwise change it as little as possible so that its cultural significance is retained. I ask the council to defer this planning permit decision, to initiate a review and revision of the proposed plan in this post-COVID world to more effectively engage with the traders and community. Engage an independent outside organisation agreed to by stakeholders to do the work, then allow appropriate time for the community to assess and comment properly before proceeding. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary Lou. I now call on Lee Moore to speak for no more than 3 minutes. Welcome to Town Hall, Lee.
It's Leah, thank you.
My apologies, Leah.
I'm speaking on my dad's behalf, as he wasn't in, he couldn't get in on time for this one. So thanks for the opportunity to speak. I strongly oppose to the granting of these planning applications. The proposed buildings are unnecessary. They will look out of place and inhibit the ebb and flow of access to the market. If anything, these lockdowns have shown how critical close access and practical parking is to the market, as is easy vehicle access to the car park must stay where it is. As well as the service buildings on the side of the car park, the Queen Street plans are only to facilitate unnecessary redevelopment and the sale of land, which in the present climate is totally inappropriate. I hope the new councillors appreciate how important the market is to the people of Victoria. Remember, the site was a bequest from Queen Victoria to the people of Victoria to operate as a traditional market nearly 150 years ago. It must retain its old-fashioned charm, hustle and bustle, and lack of uniformity. We should be building on its difference, not trying to be like everyone else. and criticising a Dickinson image shown how out of touch some people are. Good markets evolve very slowly over time. Each one is different and changes as they need to change. They have been doing so since the dawn of time and indeed are the purest form of commerce. How sad is it that people can now sit in front of a screen and their food arrives by mysteriously at their homes, soulless and hollow. Really, I feel really sorry for my grandkids and the future generations. Remember the joy of our childhood. Remember, I'm talking for my dad. we only have to look as far as the corridor market, which Dad used to go to see what inappropriate redevelopment does. This market is now a car park. Where are we? Ask the RMIT report for intangible values, concerned that candidates who strongly oppose the market were not re-elected or elected. Ask that you proceed with great caution and considerateness, as a council election took place under the shroud of COVID, also with the gerrymander and little transparency. People go to start came to the market to get a start in life, such as Spotlight, and a few other major changes, which are now all over the country. Bolle was another one. Thank you, and be kind to the old girl. Stay safe. Thanks to Normie Gallagher, etc. And thank you very much.
Thanks, Leah, for your contribution. I now call on Tristan Davies from the Melbourne Heritage Action to speak for no more than 3 minutes. Welcome back to Town Hall, Tristan.
Thank you. It's been a while, at least virtually. Thank you, Lord Mayor and councillors. I'm not going to speak for too long because I think a lot of my ideas have already been spoken about quite well. I am speaking probably more as a trader, as a shopper and a worker at the Queen Vic Market rather than as heritage per se. I would like to just say in terms of these applications that it is quite good, actually, I think, to see a lot of focus on sustainability, which is something that the Victoria market's really fallen behind. I think if you look at somewhere like South Melbourne Market, they do a much better job of incorporating sustainability and modern practices while also, you know, keeping the character of the market alive. So hopefully that's going to be something positive coming out. But I did just want to put on record a couple of criticisms from the report that I've seen today. Firstly, just that I find it a bit troubling that concerns about affordability and rent increases were simply dismissed as not being a planning matter. I understand that technically this is definitely true, that you can't think about these things in terms of your decisions tonight, but I think for it simply to be dismissed in the report is a little bit troubling, because there are like legitimate concerns among the market community about what increased prices from this gentrification might bring, whether it's, you know, whether it's fruit and vegetables becoming more expensive or rents becoming more expensive or both. So it would be nice to see more comments from planners rather than simply dismissing those concerns. And you only need to look at certain other markets in Melbourne, like, for instance, Paran, where all of the heritage and planning requirements have been met, but the market character is really gone because everything's too expensive there. And there's no point going there when you can just go to a supermarket. On that note as well, I would also just like to take concern, like others, with the comment that the unorganised and cluttered appearance of the market and stock infers that improved storage is necessary. I think not just from a heritage perspective, but from someone who shops there every week and actually works there in tourism, I can say that the unorganised and cluttered appearance is actually a major appeal of the market for visitors, not a fault in need of removal, as some, like the previous Lord Mayor, might believe. A large part of the appeal of the market, I think, in shopping there is the ad hoc, bustling nature of the market, and even the fact that you see forklifts going up and down all day and traders busy with maybe, you know, debris and cluttered, you know, trading going on. But still, it's part of the gritty atmosphere of the market that I think visitors come to see. You know, it's more than just going to a supermarket where everything's behind closed doors and you have no connection to where the food is coming from beyond it looking nice under a nice display, where you can just pick it up and pay for it, you know, at the check-in. So I think that's something that really needs to be a little bit reconsidered. And I think, as has been said before, I think that's only really coming from one very narrow perspective, from a planner's perspective and a logistics perspective, but not from what traders and visitors, I think, are actually saying about the theatre of the market. So I don't know if the entire process needs to be rethought, but it certainly seems like the ball has been rolling for a few years without really any thought on whether all the changes are necessary and whether they need to be rethought.
All right. I will ask you to conclude now, Tristan. Thank you for your contribution this evening. It's very much appreciated. I now call on Miriam Fain, Friends of Queen Victoria Market, to speak for no more than 3 minutes. Welcome back to Town Hall, Miriam. It's been a while.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Okay. Well, I'm a bit surprised by your comments that we're only to talk about the planning aspects, because my comments are going to respond to what was in the documentation offered to the meeting, that is with the planning application. And I think it's quite legitimate to respond to those. And I also want to comment on both proposals in both my responses, because the proposals, in fact, are generic in that they refer to an operational change in the market that goes well beyond the buildings. And the reason for that is this, that these $40 million buildings will not help the market at all as it presently functions. Management knows right now that the trader's shed cannot accommodate enough produce storage for the current traders, never mind for more in the future. And the planning application itself actually points out that the northern shed will create a logistical nightmare. It says there is an internal operational issue that there will not accommodate all the loading requirements. The plan changes to the delivery operations do not resolve the logistics issues. This is a matter for the managers of the market to consider. So why are you spending $40 million on two buildings that are not going to solve the problem that you claim they're there for? What's the point of that? And I foreshadow that these buildings, in fact, are about changing the market intrinsically. They're about getting rid of a lot of traders, and that way you'll have plenty of storage. Yes, the market needs some updating. Yes, there are certainly some issues with health and safety and so on. However, The proposed infrastructure and storage suggests a shopping centre operational model. Traders will be forced to store goods and perishables in the new sheds. You'll centralise delivery, unloading and stocking of fresh produce. And that's the way a shopping centre works, not the way a market works. The hours and movements of traders will be restricted. Traders will be forced to load and unload at designated times. Basically, traders themselves have much better ideas than this to update the logistics of the market, and those ideas will cost a hell of a lot less than $40 million. Okay, now the market was crowded over Easter. It was really apparent again how many country people and people from the outer suburbs brought their families into the market to enjoy and because they depend on the traditional market. The market has a place and it can thrive again as it traditionally was. But nothing planned in these plans will achieve that. There's nothing here for traders. There's nothing here for customers. As the traders tell me, you've got an agenda, and that's what these plans are about. And that's to change the kind of market and the kind of investment you see in the market space. And I'll address what those changes are when I talk to you again in a few minutes.
Thank you, Miriam. We look forward to that. I now call on Tony Ansaldo to speak for no more than 3 minutes.
Hello, can you hear me?
Loud and clear, Tony.
Yeah. I'm a trader currently trading in the market. I'm not too sure because, as the others, I didn't know it was just about the application. But just on that, I can't see how the proposed building matches, I don't know the specific laws around it, but matches what the purpose is for, you know, planning and for the planning laws, because Queen Street is a major thoroughfare for trade. I'm not sure if you talked to management, but when Saturday trade was cut off from Queen Street traffic, we were down about 30-40% in sales. So if that is a permanent closure of the street, I'm not sure how that will impact on our business, whether it will be viable or not. Furthermore, you know, I think the way the building's come and the operational, like the storage and that, we aren't aware of what the requirements are or what we're going to get, if we can park our truck, anything. There's a lot of worry in the market community. And I see $40 million, but I really don't see where that's going to benefit our businesses going forward. It just increases risk. Like I've heard, it's an 8, 9 o'clock cutoff. I'm not too sure if any of you are aware to get from Epping to buy stock, to load it safely, come back, how we're going to do that. And you multiply that across 70-odd traders, plus butchers, plus, you know, the fish people, anybody else. I really don't know how this will work. And then you look at it furthermore, you got Aldi in the city, you got North Melbourne there, Woolworths, you got 24-hour loading and unloading. How this occurs in Queen Victoria market, it's just going to sort of put a dent in everybody's businesses. So, and we forget they're all individual businesses, so we're all just trying to make a living, and I just sort of can't see how operationally and management-wise that this will benefit us in any way. And I just hope you consider that, you know, it is a very important street in the product, like in the economics of the market and the cohesion of the market, and it'll further segregate the northern sheds from the southern sheds going forward. So I really hope you put that into your perspective, because that was one of the original concerns, that there's a divide between the market with the street. So if you want to make it Swanston Street walk, I think people just keep on walking. So you really got to think about that for the future. Now, that's it. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Tony, for your contribution. I now call on Frank Fontana to speak for no more than 3 minutes.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks, Frank. You're coming through loud and clear.
Thank you. Well, many traders find disappointing is that we have offered a number of solutions to management and members of council that we believe reach the same objective. We believe these ideas to be more practical, cost-effective and efficient. We would love to show you these ideas and explain how they would work. How do you expect us to support this proposal when we don't know how much space a trader will be eligible for or how much the market intends to charge in rent? We also have a serious concern about how workable it will be. Through communication with management, our understanding is that space will be limited. So we're spending millions of dollars, yet we won't have an abundance of space. Why are we spending more money to get less? Why? The market has long run on a high turnover, low cost system. While spending millions of dollars sounds great, we need to make sure that that system is maintained. I leave you with this. Don't take traders' silence as a show of support. Take it as a show of failure from management to successfully communicate with their customers. Many traders don't know what's going on or are too afraid to speak out publicly. Most of senior management's time is spent on issuing lollipop beach notices, which they can then use to selectively cancel businesses. So we need to look at what we do today, because another major point for the traders is we're struggling now, and we think, you know, these developments is 2-3 years away. The way things are going, we may not be there. So, you know, we need something in the interim to keep us going. We need some big action taken now to stabilize the market before it just keeps going down, down, down. So, you know, we'd like to see a bit of focus on that. That's about it for me. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Frank, for your appreciation, for your contribution. Much appreciated. Now call on Daniel Susan and Mia Zarr from Tract Consultants to speak for no more than 3 minutes.
Thank you, Councillor Rees. Whilst there are two separate agenda items, 6.1 and 6.2, we've consolidated our submission to cover both matters in this 3 minutes. Tract Consultants were engaged by the City of Melbourne to assist in the preparation, lodgement, management of the planning permit applications for both the Trader Shed and the Northern Shed. The subject sites are located within the capital city zone, affected by both heritage overlays and design and development overlays. We note that a planning permit is not required under the heritage overlays for either proposal, as the sites are included on the Victorian Heritage Register. A separate Heritage Victoria application was lodged and considered by Heritage Victoria, and a heritage permit has since been issued for the development subject to conditions. As such, heritage matters, including any demolition and new works proposed, are not relevant in the consideration of these planning permit applications, the only trigger being under the capital city zone and the DDOs. The proposals before you tonight have been guided by the QBM master plan and are the result of a highly collaborative design approach, including extensive engagement with QBM Proprietary Limited, the Office of the Victorian Government Architect, Heritage Victoria, and the City of Melbourne Planning and Urban Design departments. The proposals have been specifically designed to respond to the objectives of the QBM master plan for the Q1, Q2 and Market Cross C2 precincts, and are consistent with the People's Panel principles. Specifically, the projects include the delivery of necessary infrastructure to support the ongoing role of the QBM as a retail and visitor destination, improved amenity for the traders with dedicated facilities including bathrooms, showers and community areas for their use, enhanced sustainability outcomes for the QBM with a particular focus on waste management and recycling, and an improved public realm, including increased safety with clearer delineation of loading areas to reduce conflict between loading vehicles and pedestrians. Throughout the design process, the project team have been cognizant of the sensitivity of the Queen Victoria market, its importance to Melbourne's architectural and cultural heritage, and its authentic character as a metropolitan produce market. NH Architecture have developed design responses which are sympathetic to this context. The Trader Shed has been designed as a simple and functional market building, which maintains the sight lines of the adjoining heritage buildings and adopts complementary materials. With the removal of the originally proposed canopy under the heritage permit, the Northern Shed presents an even lighter touch, with only minor public realm interventions proposed to allow for segregated loading and improve pedestrian safety. We're happy to advise that the project team have reviewed and are comfortable with the recommended conditions set out in the officer reports. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that, Daniel. Given there are no further presenters this evening, I now propose to move a motion which is appearing on the screen. Just while that's coming up, I will check if any councillors have any questions for Larry Parsons or Roger Teal or any other officers off the back of the submissions this evening. Okay, in that case, I will move the motion that's appearing on the screen. Then I'm looking for a councillor to second it. Thank you, Councillor Lippitt, and I will now speak to this motion. As I said at the outset, the question before councillors tonight is whether or not the development proposal that has been submitted is relevant with state and local planning policy. The purpose here is to consider whether a planning permit application should be granted for the approval for demolition of a building, construction of a new building, and alteration to access to a road. The detailed application, as we've heard from Larry Parsons and further from Daniel Susan, looks to demolish the existing trader building and toilet block located within the market and construct a new three-storey building with four basement levels to be used for loading, storage, waste, and public amenities and trader facilities. It should be pointed out that the building that is proposed to be demolished is not a heritage-graded building, although the Queen Victoria Market is listed on the Victorian Heritage Register and Heritage Victoria has assessed and issued a permit for the proposal. The Heritage Victoria response does make for interesting and good reading. I think it's fair to say that there has at times been a tortured history between the City of Melbourne and Heritage Victoria around the redevelopment of Queen Victoria Market, but I'm very pleased to say that I think the contribution and submission by and recommendations by Heritage Victoria are absolutely first rate on this particular application, and I'm very pleased to see that the City of Melbourne has adopted those recommendations. Specifically, the provision of additional basement level and partial relocation of rooftop plant to the basement, that's will provide improved amenity and improved street interface. The inclusion of a gable form in to Queen Street and variations to height and roof form. I agree that's consistent with other buildings along Queen Street. The replacement of the existing gates with two sets of drop chain bollard systems. And finally, my favourite, modifications to materials and the inclusion of brick in the building. Now, the beauty of brick, of course, is that not only does it look good at point of construction, but it actually gets better with age. And the use of hatch brick and other brick patterns, I think, in this design will be a real addition to the design at Queen Victoria Market, and also does so with a material that is consistent with what is at the Queen Victoria Market at the moment. The officer's report makes it very clear that the development is consistent with all relevant state and local planning policy, that it responds appropriately to the built form guidance in the in DDO 14, Area 16, and it also, I also welcome the finding that the traffic conditions resulting from the proposal have been reviewed by the City of Melbourne's traffic engineers, and they have identified that it does not raise any significant issues. And I think that goes also to some of the OH&S issues we heard raised by some of our submitters this evening. So taking all those matters into account, put the motion to councillors this evening and speak in favour of it. Councillor Lippitt.
Thank you, Chair. I certainly agree with all of that, and thank you for setting out the framework within which we're making the decision today. I will address the matters raised by objectors, but considering our role as the responsible authority and whether or not a planning permit should issue, clearly I think a planning permit should issue. This is the lesser of the two controversial items, if you like, tonight, and perhaps there'll be a slightly longer debate on the next, but I was also interested in the Heritage Victoria permit process. I would have thought that the conversion to brick and the gabled roof form might have created a situation where it looks like the design is seeking to mimic what is found in some of the other sheds, and perhaps that's why we weren't going down that road to begin with the metallic sheets. However, Heritage Victoria encouraged the use of brick, and I'm equally happy with that particular outcome. And what's being put to us now by the applicant, which also happens to be the City of Melbourne, is that the plans that were put forward simply be conditioned to reflect all of those heritage permit conditions applied by Heritage Victoria, which makes perfect logical sense, even if it's quite complicated for the reader to understand what all of those conditions might mean in practice, because some of the drawings, some of the plans in this and the next item will still be the pre-Heritage Victoria amended plans. And so I acknowledge the complication of the task for the reader. But a permit should issue, because clearly the application in a planning, from a planning perspective, complies with state and local planning controls and policies. Objectors didn't raise any issues in relation to state and local planning policies and controls today, but let's acknowledge as well that there's still a lot of concern about the Queen Victoria Market renewal project generally. As you pointed out, Chair, that those aren't matters for discussion at this point. That would be improper for us as the responsible authority to canvass now. I merely make the point that the review of the retail plan, the review of the business case for the renewal of Queen Victoria Market generally, and any subsequent changes that would need to be made following those reviews to the master plan or any individual component of the renewal project, matters for decision that will come. They're not being made here and now. That would be improper. But starting with the review of the retail plan and the business case, these are decisions that will come. And so the feedback that was expressed tonight will have a place and a time to be heard when those decisions come. But for the task before us tonight, it's actually a relatively straightforward task, and a permit should be issued.
Thank you, Councillor Lippert. Are there any other speakers for or against this motion? Looking around, and I can't see any other speakers, so in that case, I will put this motion to the vote. All those in favour, please raise your hand. Everyone, I declare that carried unanimously. We now move on to the next agenda item, 6.2, for planning permit application TP-220-101, Queen Victoria Market, Northern Shed, 16-94 Peel Street, Melbourne. I'll check if any councillors have a conflict on this item, taking that as a no. Again, Larry, we call on you to speak to us briefly about this agenda item. Thank you, Larry Parsons, Practice Leader, Land Use and Development.
Thank you, Deputy Lord Mayor. Next slide, please. Once again, here you'll see Queen Street in the middle, and to the north is where this proposal for the what is called the Northern Shed is located. Next slide. You'll see the two orange buildings are actually the one at the bottom is the trader shed we talked about previously. So you'll see an indicative truck coming in from the south on Queen Street. It can unload out of hours at the trader shed, or it can continue on to the northern or upper shed on the screen, which was mostly for waste, and it can unload and pick up there and continue out onto Victoria Street. That's how the system works. And on the right-hand slide is our in trading hours. There will be none of that truck access, and it will be public available space. Next slide. Now, this is, as Councillor Leppert explained, difficult to follow because the plans have not been amended following the Heritage Victoria conditions. So you're seeing there what was called the Northern Shed because it had a roof, Basically, underground is the waste storage and processing. There is a hydraulic lift for access to those facilities, and there is a smaller vertical core. Plus, there was to be a retail pod beside that. The Heritage Victoria assessment has removed the roof. It has removed the retail pod. So we are left basically with in-ground facilities, not normally visible, with some barriers, operable barriers around them for safety in the times when the trucks are actually at the facility. Next slide, please. Here you'll see it from the ground level, and that's an artist's impression of obviously out of service hours, in the market hours. The space could be used more generally for the public, and there will be streetscape improvements and new tree planting to replace trees which might be lost through the works. That is not actually the subject of the planning permit, the streetscape works, but they are shown here indicatively. Next. Here's in plan form. You'll see the sort of the truck swept paths. The little building in the middle, the pink part, was the retail pod, which is gone. And so it's reduced in footprint, and the roof is the dotted outline, which is also gone. You'll see some indicative black lines, which are the operable barriers, and which will also include planter boxes around that. Next slide. A bit closer in. As I said, the pink part is gone. Next slide. The same. And the next slide. This is actually the basement showing all the different processing. And these are the elevations. Once again, showing a roof which is no longer there. Next. From the other side. There are about 11 trees to be removed, potentially, and that is not because of the roof works, it was because of the drainage works to happen underground to eliminate occasional flooding from what is the food court area. When those works are determined in detail, there may be less trees removed, but there is an intention to replace with about 15 new trees, and there will obviously be a process before trees are removed, as there always is with council trees. Next slide. This is the section where you can see in the yellow colour, the underground part, the now to be reduced above ground pod area, and the roof is gone. Next. There are a series of service conduits going between the sheds with some pop-up bollard style access points. And next slide. That's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Larry. Any questions for Larry from councillors? No? Okay, in that case, we will move on to our presenters, and I now call on Heather Lawrence, who requested the opportunity to address the committee in relation to this matter, to speak for no more than 3 minutes. Welcome back again, Heather.
Okay, well, I'll get my full 3 minutes. And mostly what I want to say is, in a way, an observation of what I've been listening to. So it's always occurred to me that there are competing world views when we speak about the way that these renewal plans were developed in the very first place and what we have now. In some ways, as presenters have said, an unchanged version post-COVID. But I also want to refer you, because the thing that really interests me is, for instance, the triple bottom line for business that included social impact and the wider perspective beyond profit and loss is something that I see is very clearly there for in words for the Queen Victoria Market Board of Management. I also notice that the City of Melbourne commit to the Sustainable Development Goals from the UN. And what I notice is a disconnect. I always see a disconnect when I hear the traders try to speak about what's going on for them. I've also heard members of your elected representatives say that how disturbing the trader representative group operates because of the imbalance of power. And I myself have launched into these meetings on occasions over these last 10 years, right in the beginning before some of the councillors here were elected, and found that always the voices of traders were seen as bothersome and very annoying. And the worst comment of all of that, of course, was when the previous Lord Mayor called them bogans, as I have mentioned several times. So I want you to consider, what does renewal mean in relation to the Sustainable Development Goals, in relation to a true triple bottom line of what a business is doing in these days post-COVID, and how do you see the relationship between the development of the market and the cohesion and connection of the trader community and the feelings of the wider community? And I really call on you to reflect on what that means to you. Otherwise, it's just trotting out the renewal as if the word means something that we all share and understand. But I can tell you now, I do not share your understanding.
Thank you, Heather. I now call on Jane Stanley to speak for no more than 3 minutes.
Thank you, councillors. I want to talk about waste management, and I've been dealing with waste management and different technologies for managing wastes in markets. It's probably the number one complex infrastructure problem. But I would urge council to carefully consider the risks in what's being proposed. So I'm particularly concerned about how it's proposed to handle food wastes, but also the reliance on very careful separation of wastes, because I know that it's extremely difficult to implement that. So with the food wastes, the proposal is to macerate it, mix it with water, pipe it into 6,000 litre tanks underground, and then to pump those out at an undisclosed it says up to five times a week, but doesn't actually specify. There will be couplings at ground level, and trucks will link onto those couplings, put the waste inside the truck, and it will go off. Now, in terms of sustainability, I would really want to know where it goes. Is council interested in a circular economy? These are very valuable waste resources if you've separated them. Are they just going to go to landfill, or are they going to be processed for highest net value? So that's a more strategic issue. But in terms of the risks, I understand that there has been some past trialling of different waste management technologies at Queen Victoria Market. The traders haven't necessarily supported what's gone on, and vandalism has been a huge problem, as well as contamination of the different waste streams. Now, this particular proposal, if there is likely to be vandalism, just consider what could go wrong. You've got a macerator. What happens if people deliberately put metal into it and it blocks up? What happens if there's a strike and the sludge from the 6,000 litre tanks underground isn't collected and it starts to produce biogas? Where is it being vented anyway? I can't see it's explained. Is it coming out in the middle of the food court? And what happens to the couplings in the street that the trucks connect to if somebody's stuffed up the coupling? So I think there are a lot of risks that the council would need to be satisfied on before you approve this particular waste management proposal.
Thank you very much, Jane. I now call on Charles Sourwine from the Royal Historical Society of Victoria to speak for no more than 3 minutes. Welcome back, Charles.
Thank you. There's a paradox of our planning laws, which we owe to Jeff Kennett, that the council as responsible authority decides on a project that council has been pushing in effect in various guises for 6 years. The assurances that there will be a review ring a bit hollow, because in this case, the Northern Shed is the key driver of the radical change in the mode of operation of the market, which is at the heart of renewal. And that's a change from the traditional mode of operation where stallholders bring their goods to their own stalls in their own vehicles, set up their stalls, and they operate often from the vehicles. That results in a jostling, bustling, cluttered jumble, or unorganized and cluttered, as the council has put it more recently. And that is what is it's aimed to change in this proposal. There is a heritage issue in this, in that the citation for the statement of significance for the market in the Victorian Heritage Register is indeed for its operation as a traditional fruit, fresh food and meat market, it operating as I've just put. The shift away from that is exactly the opposite of what customers value in the market, and I call on councillors who do want to think about the whole issue to go back to the council, the report that council commissioned, the Queen Victoria Market Intangible Values, which pointed to the anxiety that the market might be cleaned up or sanitized, made to look like a food hall, and commented that movement was essential to the market and the perceptions of the market, cars, trucks, forklifts, trolleys, prams, scooters, bins and boxes. They saw that as something positive. The People's Panel noted that any program of restoration and renewal should preserve and maintain the social and intangible cultural heritage significance of the market. It should retain and display all the vibrancy and theater of a traditional market, including delivery and unloading, setting up and taking down. Your reports allude explicitly to centralized loading for subsequent distribution to sale stalls known as point of sale, which would in fact be fixed stalls. That is a proposal to change the market completely, and that's what you're going to endorse tonight, even though you will say you are only doing the planning aspects of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Charles. And now, Councillor Leppard.
Thank you, Professor. Just a question on the heritage aspects. I know the argument you're putting to us, and as you set out, the heritage considerations aren't before us because the site is on the State Heritage Register. Therefore, a heritage permit was required. Therefore, the matter of whether or not the proposal meets the statement of significance and the citation and the provisions of the Heritage Act was decided already by Heritage Victoria and cannot be considered by us tonight. My question is, did you make a submission to the heritage permit process, and do you disagree with the outcome of the Heritage Victoria's decision? Secondly, is it possible to make any built alterations to the market that would change the use even marginally? Where does that margin end? Thank you, Professor.
Thank you, Councillor Leppard. I must say that I remain always very respectful of your heritage knowledge and understanding and the work you've done in other areas. I'm sorry that we disagree on this particular matter, but as we both know, this goes back a long way. We did, of course, make extensive submission to Heritage Victoria, and many of our concerns were met. And to go on to the question you've asked, I should say that the one question that Heritage Victoria did not take up was what the social value, which has now been added, as you know, to the heritage criteria, and which we believe is a very major part of the Queen Victoria market as suggested in its statement of significance, although that statement of significance predates by a long time the adoption of the social value criterion. So we didn't get satisfaction from Heritage Victoria on that. We did get satisfaction in a large number of the actual heritage values of the built form that have resulted, and I think I made that clear in my previous intervention on this matter. I would be happy with the trader shed with some further design changes to lighten it. So we certainly, the RHSV, does not contest the possibility of sympathetic built form responding to the rhythms and building envelopes of the site when they're necessary. And there's a lot in Trader Shed which we would support. What we don't support is a radical change to the mode of operation. Apart from the heritage ground, and I suppose I'm slipping off my my formal position here, but apart from the formal heritage aspects, we think that the this is the cultural value for Melbourne. We think that if you lose that excitement, there's nothing, no work has been done to show that this will draw more people to the market if you move to more value add, which has been the central theme there, value add and events. And when you centralize the loading and set up point of sale, you are going to have that radical change to the operation, and that's the whole point of Northern Shed.
Charles, I'm going to ask you to conclude now. We do have other presenters that we need to hear from, so thank you very much for your contribution, and thank you for your contribution on other heritage matters around our city. I now call on Leah Moore to speak for no more than 3 minutes. Welcome back, Leah.
And something the council has proposed to do supposedly to improve the market. Queen Street is basically the heart of the market with arteries and veins that flow into it from all the streets. When you close off Queen Street, the main artery into the heart of the market, to the vehicles, the heart dies. So does the rest of the market, the body. We all rely on each other, all traders. If one part doesn't work, the rest of us won't. Has anyone actually come into the market on a busy afternoon or busy morning between the hours of 7 and 12 and counted how many vans and trucks are there unloading and loading to the various stalls? If you did that, you'd be quite shocked, I'm sure. And you'd understand that what your proposal is won't work. So my question is, when are you going to start listening to the majority of traders and customers, not just the ones who will be who will give you the answers you want? As Dr. Jane Stanley said on 3RW and also this evening, you need to work with the traders who know what's best with the market. As shown when installing the traffic barriers in Queen Street, a fruit and veg trader had to tell the staff, your staff, where they were planning, what they were planning to do wouldn't fit a truck, let alone a large truck. Luckily, the City of Melbourne listened this time. And as the People's Panel said, which I was part of, a majority of us wanted to keep Queen Street open, purely for the fact that it's ease of access to all areas of the market, and it's ease of access for customers to get fruit and veg, for parents like myself to come in, quickly grab something with the kids without having to drag them all over the market. And it's also one other thing that my kids love watching is the forklifts, unloading and loading the trucks. When we're there working, you can stand at the bottom on D Shed and watch the forklifts loading the pallets into the trucks. You don't see this anywhere else in the world or in Australia. It's something that's unique. It basically looks to me like you're just making everyone's lives harder. So we all give up and leave, then you will truly have a derelict market after wasting $40 million of ratepayers' money, especially now post-COVID. But as we've just seen, you guys will approve everything as you're putting the plans in, so of course you're going to approve them. Thank you.
Thanks, Leah. I now call on Miriam Fain to speak for no more than 3 minutes. Welcome back, Miriam.
Okay. Well, I was really surprised you haven't redone the drawings, or the person who presented hadn't redone the drawings of the Northern Shed. I thought that was an extraordinary thing to show us out-of-date drawings today. And I wonder if that means you are rethinking the whole thing, and I hope you are. I'm pleased to hear that you're going to review the retail plan and perhaps the business case, because the reality is they were written in 2014. They were produced by a totally discredited mayor who you know, who was interested in his own profile, I think one can say, and saw this as a way to become glorious. The renewal that he set up talks about the market as a place, not as a form of trading, but a market is not just a place. As the traders have explained tonight, and also Jane Stanley, it's a kind of trading, and we're going to lose that. Now, those documents were reviewed in 2017 and 2019, and that's all pre-COVID. Okay, and I have to say that I've read all the documentation very closely. And if you look at the retail plan, the business plan, the renewal plans, you'll see that what is in fact being set up is a bland, generic space, which will be a kind of event space. You're looking to hire it out for weddings, fashion week, opera, Melbourne Food and Wine Festival. The vision is that the market is reduced to a very small rump, a boutique market, and the rest of the market will allegedly be raising revenue for the council. And I don't think it will make more money. For a start, as Jane Stanley's told us, for the 400 temporary jobs you might gain, you're going to lose 6,000 or perhaps 25,000 permanent jobs. The market makes a huge contribution, and the figures in the retail plan, in fact, do not include the costs of the redevelopment. So you have forecast an income spinner in the future without looking at what it means in terms of the bottom line, which is very, very odd. I'm not an accountant, but it seems to me it's total adventurism. And that is without taking into account the effects of COVID. You have a city now that is devoid of people, a city with no tourists, no international students, no immigrants. I don't know who's going to buy the apartments in Munro's. And I certainly think you need to rethink the development in Franklin Street. So you're committing to spend $40 million tonight on something that was set up in 2014 and doesn't take any account of COVID at all. And the last point I want to make is that your planning documentation tonight doesn't consider at all the effects of further rebuilding on a market and the traders, which have been devastated by the forced closure last year and this year, that has been enormously impacted, like the rest of the city, by COVID. And yet you want to go in there and start doing colossal building works in the middle of the market, just as traders are beginning to recover. You spend more time looking at the effects of construction on trees in this documentation than you spend looking more space than you spend considering the effects of this building works, these unnecessary expensive building works, on traders.
Thank you, Miriam. Your 3 minutes is up. Appreciate your spirited contribution to the debate this evening. Now, my notes here say that Daniel Susan and Mia Zahr have requested the opportunity to speak, but I just want to check, Daniel, if you are still online, did you wish to speak to this particular item, or were your comments on the previous item covering both?
Thank you, Councillor Rees. No, the intention was that the comments on the previous item would cover both. Okay. But we're here to answer any questions if they should arise.
All right, thank you. Now, I also believe that Stan Lakos is with us this evening virtually. I'd like to just invite Stan to respond to any matters raised this evening that he thinks need response in the context of the planning matter which is before us this evening.
Hello, councillors, it's Stanley Akos. The only matter that probably just needs a little bit of amplification is the analysis and work that we've done with the city on the waste management facility. And our GM of operations, Mark Bullen, is also on the line, and I've invited him to speak. So, Mark, are you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. Hello, councillors.
Thank you.
In regards to the waste management comments, currently the market's waste management is completely inadequate. The proposed waste management systems that have been developed have been well thought through with the city, QVM, and the consultants that are working on the project. Specifically in relation to the on-site treatment of organic waste, I wanted to advise that we have taken on board the issues of the trial that we completed a year ago, which was an on-site treatment facility. And we've moved away from that. It was a trial, and we've taken on board the feedback, and we've developed the system further. The current solution We'll collect all of our organic waste and store this in holding tanks, and that organic waste will then be transported of an evening to a facility that will convert it from waste to energy. So there will be a circular economy, there will be an alternate use for this product. It is a very important product. Should one of those elements fail in the system due to vandalism or other reasons, we have multiple redundancies built into the system. There are five of these units that will be located across the site, and we will have the ability to utilise those should one or two fail. So we're quite confident that this system has the redundancy and the backup in the event we have challenges. Finally, I'd just like to highlight that we are striving to achieve a goal of zero waste to landfill by 2027 at the market. This system and the other systems that, from a waste management point of view, will help us achieve that. And we require this infrastructure to obviously achieve the objective of zero waste. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark, and thank you, Stan. I'm about to put a motion on the screen. Before I do so, I just want to check if any councillors have questions for any of the officers, both present here and with us virtually. I'm seeing none. In that case, I'd ask Jody to please put up on the screen a motion, there it is, 6.2. And I now move this motion before councillors, looking for a councillor to second. Thank you, Councillor Leppard. I'll speak quite briefly to this matter. This application seeks to carry out works within the northern part of Queen Street, as we've heard, including public realm, landscaping upgrades and a new underground waste sorting facility. The new basement will contain a storage area, waste room and other features. The Queen Victoria Market is listed in the Victorian Heritage Register, and accordingly Heritage Victoria has assessed and issued a permit for the proposal with changes that require the canopy above the loading area to be removed, removal of the retail pod, removal of the sign and rearrangement of the landscaping and lay down area. And again, the City of Melbourne officers have accepted those proposed design modifications, and that's what is before us this evening. In terms of the planning rules that apply, the development is clearly consistent with all relevant state and local planning policy and responds appropriately to the built form guidance at clause 22.01, urban design within the capital city zone, and the design objectives of the built form outcomes of DDO 14-area 16. The proposed public realm upgrades and single-storey structure located within Queen Street will improve loading and waste management without detracting from precinct character. As I've said, Heritage Victoria supports the amended design. Councillor Leppard.
Thank you, Chair. I agree again. This matter is more complicated than the last, I believe, and that's because the alterations required by Heritage Victoria in order for a heritage permit to issue are significant and cause for the applicant, who also happens to be the City of Melbourne, a rethink of the workability of the proposal. Now, those aren't matters for us to consider here today, but again, listening to submitters, to objectors, we have to acknowledge that the purpose, the waste reduction purpose, the public safety purpose, the sustainability purposes, the heritage purposes and the use purposes of the what was the northern shed, but let's now call it the northern facilities, have not been well explained. And more than that, actually, the applicant, the City of Melbourne, will need to keep ensuring that this one-of-a-kind boutique, waste and recycling operation, once it goes into the ground, is going to work, right? Like this is a very significant change to engineering in the public realm, and it's not at all surprising that there's so many applications from members of the public and key stakeholders before us. Midstream, after the application for the planning application was made, we're considering the application without the roof, without the retail pod. I'm grateful to Professor Sarwine for his expansion on some of the heritage matters. I was fascinated by the Heritage Victoria process, which completely rewrote the planning application for the applicant. The applicant has some serious questions to consider about what it means to have the underground services without a roof in terms of waterproofing and a whole lot of other issues. Those issues can all be dealt with quite in a straightforward fashion, I think, but it's incumbent on the applicant, the City of Melbourne, to explain in a very transparent way how the revised scheme for the northern shed, the northern facilities, will meet all these purposes that we're claiming are inherent in the scheme that we put out a year ago. But again, the proposal for us today is, does this planning application meet the provisions of the state and local planning controls and policies? The answer is yes. We're not considering heritage today because Queen Victoria Market Friends insisted that this should be a National Heritage listed site, but it's on the State Heritage Register. This is out of the hands of the local council. The advocates for the market do not want the council to consider heritage. That is why it's on the State Heritage Register. That's why there was a heritage permit that had to issue before the planning permit. And so it's gone through the heritage permit process. The Friends of Queen Victoria Market don't want us to consider heritage as part of the planning permit, until they do. So we're not considering heritage tonight because that matter is dealt with by Heritage Victoria. On the other planning matters, a planning permit should issue. After today, as I said, the retail plan, the business case, other key decisions will all be made publicly under review in the normal way. Those are matters for another time. For today, the permit should issue.
Thank you, Councillor Lippitt. Are there any other speakers for or against the motion? In that case, I'll put the matter to the vote. All those in favour of the motion, please raise your hands. I declare that carried unanimously. The next agenda item before us is agenda item 6.3, planning permit application TP-2020-570 for the property 165 to 167 Exhibition Street, Melbourne. Just checking no conflicts in relation to this matter. Would Council like a presentation on this one? Take that as a no as well. So I'll now call on Dennis Lavini, who requested the opportunity to address the committee in relation to this matter, to speak for no more than 3 minutes. Welcome to Town Hall, Dennis.
Thank you. I've lived in the city for 12 years or more now, and this is the first time I've needed to actually take up an issue, because I generally support appropriate development in the city. And I think it's really great that this old, you know, largely neglected building is going to get a new lease of life. So I think that's fantastic. But it's not appropriate to get that lease of life at the compromise of existing land uses around it. And in particular, the extensive number of residential addresses that front onto this property and the proposal for the property to have a rooftop area. if I go to the slides, if I could pull up the first or the second slide a little bit, you'll see that the application in the first item, diagram one, you can see the proximity of the building in the eyes of even the applicant to the balconies and the residential windows of people who have bedrooms look down onto this site. Also note that they were deceptive in the fact that they've only shown half of the Paramount building, and I filled in the bit that's been missing, which surrounds the other side of the rooftop development. On the right-hand side is more of an image. It shows the positioning of the additional story that's being added with the rooftop on the top. And if we go to the next slide, you can see this in a plan view way, of just how close some of these apartments are to the rooftop. The 10 to 15 metres is the separation between the some of the balconies of the properties and the proposed rooftop. Now, I've also put on there some numbers that are associated with the surrounding areas. If you assume that there are about 1.5 people per apartment or residential address, that's about 300 people every night that will be subjected to noise coming from this rooftop. Now, you know, it's I want to support generally the application, but surely we can have a rooftop which is much better shielded from the residential addresses that surround it. We have, you know, people who have been here for a long time, some very concerned elderly residents, that their life is going to be disturbed every night. We're going to have to put up with this. And it's not just this particular owner that's going to build it, but it's the future uses that will be put, that this rooftop will be put to, and also the precedent that sets for the rooftop next door, which we believe also is looking at opening up some sort of entertainment facility. So all I ask is that could we please have some consideration that modifies the planning application to close in this rooftop, at least substantially towards the street. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dennis, and thank you for the presentation. Can I ask, do you live in the Paramount building?
So rooftop.
Sorry, I didn't catch that.
Am I back on again now?
Yes, I was just wondering if you live in the Paramount building.
Yes, I do, and I have a bedroom that looks down on this rooftop, as do many of our residents.
All right, thanks for your presenting, and I'll address some of the matters you've raised shortly. I now call on Tristan Davies from the Melbourne Heritage Action. Back again, Tristan. Please speak for no more than 3 minutes.
No worries. Thanks again. I wanted to preface that I'm speaking to this application on behalf of a submission by Rowan Story, who's written to you. So we did object to this application primarily because it involves a version of facadism where only a few external walls are being retained on what has been listed as a significant building within the heritage grading of the City of Melbourne just recently. And we believe that this demolition is completely unsatisfactory according to the City of Melbourne's new heritage guidelines, which have been, you know, in the public debate for years and have taken quite a lot of work by the City of Melbourne to get through, and for very good reason. And we believe that judging by those guidelines, this application falls very short. Even if this building was only rated as contributory at the lower grading, it would still be unacceptable by those guidelines, which are important for our heritage. We also note that the application does not really include a heritage assessment at all beyond a broad statement about the Little Bourke precinct, and that's really a big failing of it as well. This is quite an old building. It's from 1858, the Shakespeare Hotel, and you can really tell from the unpainted chimney, which is actually visible from the laneway behind, what the building would have looked like in its glory. Yeah, there's quite a bit of research you can read that Rowan's done in the document later if you're interested in that. But we believe that the extent of demolition, which is the rear walls of the building, all internal structures and the roof, as well as the original chimney, is not correct. The actual statement from the Heritage Guidelines does read that partial demolition in the case of buildings will not be generally permitted, which is certainly what's being attempted to be permitted here. Clearly, the policy does not envision the demolition of the majority of fabric such as happening with this building, and really needs to be re-looked at. Generally, it would only be supported if at least 8 or 10 metres of the front depth of the building was retained, which is certainly not happening in terms of this application. So that's the extent, really, of our submission to this. We also note that despite some information in the planning report, the original chimney on the roof and part of the roof line is actually visible from the street if you look at it across Exhibition Street or from the laneway behind. We also think that it's a little bit absurd to assume that the neighbouring plot will be developed. I know it's described as being essentially a vacant lot in the application, but it is in fact a major driveway which services the entire laneway behind the building. So the preferred outcome we would be looking for is basically that the whole front section of the building would be retained, given its significance, together with some internal structure, and perhaps the rear wall can be opened up with a wider archway, and a more sympathetic design for the rooftop can be created, which serves both the purposes of heritage and a renewal of this building. We do also hope that the City of Melbourne works with the applicant to perhaps work on heritage grants to restore the building and get rid of the paint on the bricks. So that's about my time, so thank you.
Thank you, Tristan, and thanks for your contribution on heritage matters around Melbourne. I now call on Lucas Paterno from URPS Planning to speak for no more than 3 minutes. Welcome to Town Hall, Lucas.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Great. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, councillors, for the opportunity to make a very brief presentation at this Future Melbourne Committee on behalf of the client, who's the landowner. My name's Lucas Paterno. I'm a town planner and director of URPS. I'm here this evening to encourage you to support this proposal, which we think is a very carefully crafted design response conceived by an established architecture firm. My client has owned the property for many years, and through this application seeks an adaptive reuse of the building. The reason this application comes to you this evening is because more than 16 objections were received, most of which are outside of the ambit of planning discretion, and most of which refer to a rooftop bar which is not proposed. The site will be utilised as a restaurant, which is nested under retail premises. It's a Section 1 use in the capital city zone and does not require planning permission. This is a proposal that incorporates the restoration of and low-scale addition to an existing heritage building. We say that it has thoughtfully and respectfully responded to the current day physical and planning context. This is the view echoed by Council's internal departments, all of which support the proposal subject to conditions and none of which we contest. And I quote from the delegate report, the extension is visually recessive and displays high quality architecture and design. It will sit comfortably in the streetscape and will not unreasonably dominate the heritage place or broader heritage precinct. The alterations and additions to the existing building support its adaptive reuse and provide an attractive pedestrian-oriented ground floor frontage. Councillors, thank you for your time and we look forward to your decision of support.
Lucas, can I ask you a question? A lot of the submissions we received objecting to this planning permit application raised, as you flagged, issues that or concerns that the rooftop would be turned into a tavern or bar. Does your client have any intention to establish a bar on the rooftop of this building?
Well, not at this stage, councillor. And if I can add that if it was the intention or if that was the purpose, then another planning application would be required.
Sorry, councillor. Point of clarification. Is it the case that a planning application would be required for a tavern, however, a planning application would not be required for a bar? The reason I ask is that the land use being sought now does not require a permit. The land use being sought is retail premises. Beneath retail premises is food and drink premises. Beneath food and drink premises is bar. So if a permit were to issue tonight, is it open to the applicants to change that use to bar without requiring a planning permit in future? However, if they want to become a tavern, they would require a planning permit. And that's a question, obviously, to Larry rather than the applicant. Apologies and thank you.
Councillor Leppard, yes, a tavern does require a planning permit. At the moment, they have asked for a restaurant, which, as you said, is a Section 1 use as of right. Obviously, liquor licence is something we're not dealing with and would have to be dealt with separately with the appropriate conditions on noise, times or whatever is considered appropriate by the Commission. Yes, so that's the answer to that one.
Thank you, Larry.
Can I ask the difference between a tavern and a bar?
Larry, I take them as interchangeable, but could you explain the nuances?
They are relatively interchangeable, Councillor Wall. It's about, and the restaurant is about serving food, and normally there's requirements for the people to be seated. The difference is about the number of people seated in the restaurant use.
Thank you, Larry. All right, I would now ask Jody to put a motion up on the screen for councillors to view. And I now propose to move the motion that is on the screen, and I'm looking for a councillor to second it. Thank you, Councillor Leppard. This is a planning application in regards to a modifications to this building involving partial demolition, building works and waiver of a bicycle parking permit requirement. The key issues for consideration for councillors here this evening relate to the waiver of bicycle spaces and the proposed extent of the demolition of a heritage place and the appropriateness of a proposed extension having regard to the design objectives, built form controls of the heritage overlay and DDO schedules 1, 2 and 4. Turning first to the actual development itself, I think the officers have correctly identified that the extension is visually recessive and displays high quality architecture and design, and congratulations to Piccolo Architecture, who I think have done a very good job here. It will sit comfortably within the streetscape and will not unreasonably dominate the heritage place or broader heritage precinct, subject to some conditions that are contained in the recommendation. I will invite Councillor Leppett to speak further to those heritage items if he wishes. The important conditions which are included are the setting back of the rooftop balustrade and the pergola frame from the street facade, and the alterations and additions to the existing building support its adaptive reuse and provide an attractive pedestrian-orientated ground floor frontage. As I'm often reminded here at the City of Melbourne, heritage does not mean that a building cannot be sensitively redeveloped, and I do think that, notwithstanding the good points that were made by our friend Tristan, that this is indeed an example of that. I should say, in regard to the waiver of the bicycle spaces, that is considered appropriate in this location due to the fact that there is high public transport accessibility and availability of bicycle hoops in the immediate surrounds. I would conclude by going back to the presentation from Dennis Lavini and the concerns he raised around rooftop noise, and in particular his fear that this site may be subject to a future application as a tavern or bar. So we have heard from Lucas Paterno that there are no current plans for that to occur. We have heard from Larry Parsons, our planning expert, that should the applicant wish to operate the premises as a bar, a fresh application for a planning permit will be required, and there'll be a whole bunch of assessments that will be necessary to have be gone through as a tavern. And I would refer Dennis to the recent decision of the City of Melbourne around an application for the redevelopment of the Jobs Warehouse on Liverpool Lane, and the position of council being one to oppose that particular application, particularly because of the impact on residents along Liverpool Lane and surrounds who had lived there for many years, if not decades, in some cases. So on that note, I'm happy to recommend the recommendation and the motion before us, and turn to you, Councillor Leppett.
Thank you, Chair. I agree again. And as you say, under the current application before us, the permit triggers are all for demolition, building and works under various zones and built form overlays, and there's another little permit trigger for bicycle parking as well. But in terms of the use of what's proposed on the roof, a permit is not required. And so the primary basis for most of the objections that have been made to us, unfortunately, and I can completely understand the concerns of those who live, especially those who overlook the roof, these are not considerations that we can make today. There is simply not a permit trigger for the use. In terms of the various building and works and demolition triggers, I think our officers have done a very, very good job. I want to particularly thank Melbourne Heritage Action and Rowan Story for putting together a submission that taught me a lot about the history of this building and its place in Melbourne. The history is, and the pictorial history, in fact, is quite a good read. The one part of the submission that I'll have to reluctantly disagree with is the way the new heritage policies are to be interpreted. So this building is still classified, as I understand it, under Part B of
Clause 2204, which is heritage inside the central city, inside the capital city zone. And although the new planning scheme amendment has been put out there, it is not yet seriously entertained. It has only just been requested for exhibition. The minister hasn't yet approved exhibition. And so it's quite clear to us that the proper way to assess the grading of this building and how to assess the extent of demolition of this building is under Part B of Clause 2204, not Part A. Now, the section quoted in the submission by Melbourne Heritage Action quotes Part A, and I believe that the demolition test is clearer than what is in Part B, but we are now applying Part B, and on the basis of that advice, I think the outcome is the correct one. I don't think this is facadism. I think that it's unfortunate the extent of heritage fabric that is being lost, but because of the active uses behind the fenestration, this is actually a really good outcome. The most important thing, though, is that the front metal frame of the new form on the roof is going, and the balustrades are going to be set back so that they can't be seen from the street or, in fact, from the lane. That new built form on top of the roof would have made it quite clear that the building had been gutted, if you like, and that's no longer going to be the case. And so this proposal now can be carried forward knowing that what's going to follow will not look, appear in any way as though the heritage integrity of the building has been lost. And in fact, with the stripping back of the paint and keeping the hero of the ghost sign on the side, the Shakespeare Hotel sign, I actually think the conservation of this building is an important heritage building. We have the capacity for quite good things. I'm alarmed by the pushback by the applicant to preserve the heritage of this building, but with some good guidance from our planners, I think they've been sent the right directions as to what to do. So a permit should issue for all the triggers that we can issue a permit for, and the undertakings of the applicant have been made very clearly on the public record tonight, so let's not get bogged down in land use term definitions.
Thank you, Councillor Lippitt. Any other speakers for or against the motion? In that case, I put the motion to the vote. All those in favour, please raise your hands. I declare that carried unanimously. We now move on to the next agenda item, 6.4, which is a plans endorsement for ID-2020-2 for Icon Park Redevelopment, Princess Park, Carlton. Councillors have conflicts in regards to this item. Good to see. Would councillors like a presentation in regards to this one? I'm going to take that as a no, and I will now call on Chris Townsend, who is a board member of the Carlton Football Club, who requested the opportunity to address the committee in relation to this matter, to speak for no more than 3 minutes. Welcome to Town Hall, Chris.
Thank you. That's much appreciated. Can I indicate, councillors and Lord Mayor, that in fact, while we nominated ourselves to be heard, it was on the basis there might be any questions, although Kane Little, the CEO, might be best placed to address you on behalf of the club, and we would simply remain lest there be any questions. Thank you, councillor.
All right. Thank you, Chris. I now call on Kane Little, who is the CEO of Carlton Football Club. Did you wish to add anything, Kane?
Yeah, thanks, councillors, and thanks, Lord Mayor, for the opportunity to speak tonight. Thanks especially for the great support and collaboration for stage one of our master plan at Icon Park within the Princess Park precinct, which we commenced last year during COVID. We're extremely proud to let you know that on Monday, April 26th, we're going to complete stage one. The most important part of stage one is our new fully integrated football department. Some new councillors might not be aware, but Carlton Football Club and City of Melbourne are going to be the first partnering LGA and AFL football club anywhere in this country, where female facilities are now identical size and quality to our male change rooms. Same size, same quality. Our athletes, male and female, will share the same gym, same aquatic facilities, same football department. That's something we're incredibly proud of, and I would hope that City of Melbourne and its residents are also. Stage two of the master plan, and the stage which we're hoping for planning approval tonight, We'll further provide new away change rooms for visiting teams, particularly our visiting female teams, indoor training facilities to support the development of our players, both men and women, sports lighting to enable our AFLW matches to be broadcast quality for TV audiences, and improved spectator access and improved landscaping and connections into Princes Park. As council documentation highlights, our designs have been strongly considerate to the heritage and history of the area. They're supportive of environmental issues. And most importantly, no female will ever walk into the Carlton Football Club again and feel in any way any sense of inequality, as the facilities for our men and women now for the first time in 157 years will be totally equal. So thanks again for your time tonight and the opportunity to speak. And as Chris mentioned, Chris Vaughan and myself are here to answer any questions you may have on our project.
Thank you, Kane. I now call on Vaughan Connor from Contour Town Planning to speak for no more than 3 minutes. Welcome back, Vaughan.
Thank you, Councillor Rees. Councillor Rees, look, similar to Mr Townsend, I'm only here as backup for Kane and the submissions he's made. And if there's any technical questions that I'm able to assist with, well, I'm here for those.
All right. Thank you, Vaughan. I think some of us were expecting to hear other presenters this evening, but alas, it's just yourself, Kane, and Chris. So given there are no other presenters, I'd ask Jody to please put a motion up on the screen for us for agenda item 6.4. And I am now going to move that motion. I'm looking for a councillor to second it. Thank you, Councillor Leppett. And I'll now speak briefly to the matter. This is an application to endorse plans and related technical documents in accordance with the requirements of the previously approved incorporated document for the Carlton Recreation Ground, Princes Park. I should stress that the Minister was responsible for approving the planning scheme amendment, and Council's responsibility is for the assessment and endorsement of these plans and related technical documents. And what is before us this evening is something that can be supported by Council. I should say that I have received a number of submissions from residents and people who do live in the Princes Park area, and I want them to know that their submissions have been certainly taken into account. I would also point out that there are aspects to the redevelopment which I would hope users of the facility, but also residents of the local area, will welcome. The new generation of lights, including dimmable lights, I think is something that is positive for residents who are concerned about the number of people at the ground on game day. It is notable that there is actually a smaller number of seating under this proposal, going down from 24 to 22,000, noting that back in the 1970s, you used to get over 70,000 people at this ground on game day. There is a small decrease in overshadowing of the park, and importantly, as we have heard from Kane Little this evening, this will be absolute world-class women's change facilities that are equal to the men's at this facility, and that is a fantastic step forward for sporting facilities in the city of Melbourne. So with taking all those matters into account, I'm happy to support the motion this evening. Councillor Leppett.
Thank you, Chair. I completely agree. Before I make some very brief remarks, I'm just going to raise a little technical issue. I have pored over this report, but it shows that I haven't looked at the recommendation until now. The plans were called in, so the plans under the incorporated document, and whilst the conditions under the incorporated document require the plans to reflect certain other technical documents, no councillor has seen the construction management plan or the waste management plan or the heritage impact statement and so on. And so I would like to not be endorsing documents that I've not seen. All of these documents would normally be endorsed under delegation. And so I'd like to suggest that we put a full stop after the word plans on the second line and delete everything after that. But before I do so, I'd like to seek your indulgence, Chair, to see if that's a good idea, but also seek advice from Larry as to whether or not this is an appropriate way to go. Larry?
Yes, I understand we have delegation to endorse those documents. So happy for the change, or you could potentially agree to the officers endorsing using a delegation to endorse the plans, if you want to word it that way.
I believe you already have it, and I'm nervous about establishing that you have the delegation.
Yeah, right.
Because we have never entered into the realm of adopting those sorts of plans ourselves. I'd like to keep it in the realm of delegation before we set a terrifying precedent.
Yes.
And I start calling in construction management plans. But it's the Chair's motion, so I will see what he would like to do.
So can I clarify, Larry, if the decision was made when the decision is made under delegation, would that appear in the internal delegation decision minutes? And at that point, could councillors call the decision about those items into FMC?
It doesn't have to. We can endorse these documents without that being IGP.
We could. One suggestion is maybe just in terms of the wording and following technical documents, development plans, and maybe then and notes that. So you're not actually making a decision, but you're noting in this meeting that these matters, these following 9.3 to 9.7 will be considered under delegation.
Happy with that as well?
Yeah, so I think that
works. Yeah, that's good wording.
So, CEO, did you just want to go through that again so Jody can capture that on
the
screen?
Sure. So number 9 will stay as is, that the future Melbourne Community resolves to endorse the submitted plans and plans, full stop. And that's the development plans, 9.1. Then the next statement would read that the future Melbourne Committee notes that the following technical documents, plans and technical documents, will be considered under delegation.
Councillor Lippitt?
That's something different, but I am equally happy.
Just need to check. Do I need to now move a... I'm happy to move this alternative motion. I'll look for a councillor to second it.
Happy to keep seconding. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. I don't think we need to... I don't need to add anything further to it. Seconder?
Just speaking to the substantive again, because the plans is all we've got before us, and I think the plans should be endorsed because they are consistent with the incorporated document. The reason they're here is because when the Minister decided to allow an incorporated document, a site-specific planning scheme amendment, he effectively hardwired the planning permit into the Melbourne planning scheme. Therefore, no planning permit is required. Therefore, third-party rights are extinguished. And this has caused great concern amongst the local community. I disagree that there were no submitters. Let's remember that Mr. Turner put in a series of questions that were asked at the beginning of the meeting. There were 7, I think, which Larry's done an excellent job responding to. I know that he has corresponded with other residents and that those questions are very good ones that are held not just by him but by quite a few residents, not our residents. These are residents of Princes Hill, so residents of the city of Yarra. However, this is not a planning application. These aren't appealable, this decision tonight, but I want to thank officers for facilitating an unusual but I think an important request to have these plans considered on the public record so that in the interests of transparency and accountability, the public can see what the plans are under the incorporated document and what is actually going to be quite a remarkable redevelopment of the Carlton Recreation Ground.
Thank you, Councillor Lippitt. Councillor Ball.
I just have a quick question, looping back to the question on notice we had at the beginning of the meeting from Dr. Andrew Turner. I think he asked about the number of occasions on which night lights would be permitted, and that wasn't answered, but I think it's in the report there are a limit of 12 occasions, and could that he's expecting written response to his questions. Is that correct?
Yeah, I believe there are 12 occasions in the report, yes. Yeah, that can be added.
All right, are there any other speakers for or against the motion? Councillor Hakim.
Thank you, Deputy Lord Mayor. I'd just like to make a quick comment to commend the Carlton Football Club on this step. Sport plays such an important role in our community, but also here in supporting gender equity, and that cannot be understated. So I hope this is only the start to see the changes in physical forms that can be considered and championed around the country for women in sport. So well done. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Hakim. Any other speakers for or against the motion? Councillor Leilu.
Thank you, Deputy Lord Mayor, and I too want to echo that. I think it's surprising when the CEO of the Carlton Football Club stated that they will be the first of the in country. And given that we are home, you know, I'm very proud of that we're a sporting city, and given that we are home to, you know, Melbourne Football Club, Richmond, Carlton, North Melbourne, and dare I say it, Collingwood headquarter as well. You know, I really hope that it's great leadership from the Carlton Football Club to put this, and I would really love to, when all this stage, whether it be stage one or stage two completed, you know, would be really interested to actually having a tour of the place, because as we have dealt with in the last few times, we have actually dealt with pavilions. I think it was only last week or something, I can't remember, but you know, again, just showcase, just learning from that experience would be really great. So, but again, I think we have to commend the Carlton Football Club for taking this initiative.
Thank you, Councillor Leilu. Any other speakers for or against? Lord Mayor.
Thank you. Congratulations to everyone involved. I think it's terrific that this is an example of good collaboration across a number of organisations who have had input into this project. And I note that leadership around the change rooms and facilities for male and female participants, and that is really built around the elite teams that play at Carlton, but also has benefits for the community groups that can and will into the future be able to use those facilities. And we know that what happens at grassroots really improves and impacts positively what happens in our elite sport and vice versa. So this virtuous cycle that we see happening at Icon Park through the auspices of the Carlton Football Club and the activities on field and off, we can see really those long-term positive outcomes for many people across our community, across sport and across other ways that sport really underpins good mental health, well-being and aspirations. So for all of those reasons, I'm looking forward to supporting this motion.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. And if there are no other speakers to the motion, I will put the motion to the vote. All those in favour of the motion, please raise your hands. And I'm declaring that carried unanimously. I now call on the Lord Mayor to resume the role of Chair for the remainder of the meeting.
Thank you, Deputy Lord Mayor. It's been a busy night with those motions so far, so thank you, and to you, Councillor Leppett, for taking us through those. We're up to agenda item 6.5, which is City of Melbourne's submission to Homes Victoria's 10-year, this is a long one, this one, 10-year social and affordable housing strategy and establishment of Homes Melbourne. Councillors, would anyone like a presentation on this item? I know we've had a chance to look at it and ask questions, but thank you to Emma and the team for the preparation. I am calling on a councillor to move this motion. Councillor Ball, thank you, and a councillor to second this motion. Councillor Rees, over to you, Councillor Ball.
Thank you very much. I do commend this report to Council tonight. It's potentially very exciting to see at least two levels of government devoting serious energy and resources and attention to this vital issue. It is quite shocking to all of us to know that nearly one in three members of our residents in our municipality experience housing stress. That is, at least a third of their income is devoted to keeping a roof over their heads. One in three, that is thousands of Melburnians, tonight in insecure or inadequate housing. We estimate 5,500, we have a shortfall of 5,500 homes in the municipality, which would be classified as social or affordable. And that is what this report to state government seeks to address, and I thank all of our officers for it. It would establish a new attention from the City of Melbourne on housing in the various ways that we do it, and makes particular recommendations to the state, to Homes Victoria, in response to their strategy. In, for example, pursuing head leases for short stay accommodation, in for short-term housing, purchasing appropriate vacant properties in existing residential developments, adapting and repurposing vacant student accommodation for short-term purposes, and in the medium to long-term, refurbishing the North Melbourne public housing estate, and very importantly, advocating to state government to introduce mandatory inclusionary zoning across Victoria. It's vital that it happens simultaneously across the state. So clearly this is not just a big build, but thinking very laterally to what resources currently exist and how we plan for the future to ensure we know we more than meet the shortfall and plan for growth. So I thank you very much. I commend it to you.
Really enjoying that. Sorry. Councillor Ball, thank you. Councillor Rees, Deputy Lord Mayor, over to you.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. Can I also begin by thanking the team that prepared this submission to the Victorian Government? I think one of the reasons why the City of Melbourne punches well above its weight in policy debates in this city, in this state, in this country, is because of the quality of the policy arguments and deliberations that we put forward when these big matters are up for debate. And this submission is just another example of the excellence that we achieve on these big policy debates. So I want to single out Emma Appleton and her team in the City and Strategy branch, to Bridie Alanadale and Tanya Walkenberg, and also Kerry Hilton and Barney Wilson from Strategic Projects. The reason why this submission is so important for the City of Melbourne is because when it comes to housing affordability and addressing issues of social and affordable housing, nowhere in Victoria do we face a bigger challenge or a bigger opportunity than what we have here in the City of Melbourne. Councillor Ball took us through some of the statistics, and they are truly moving. We expect to have, we currently have an estimated shortfall of 5,500 social and affordable homes in the City of Melbourne, and this is anticipated to grow to a staggering 23,200 homes by 2036. And as we heard, there are currently 720 people in emergency hotel accommodation in our city who urgently need appropriately located supported accommodation as a pathway out of homelessness. So the size of the challenge is absolutely huge. As I said, though, the opportunity is also an absolutely huge one as well. And that's why what's being proposed here, including the establishment of Homes Melbourne, I think is so important. We shouldn't forget that the City of Melbourne actually has a very long, proud history in this area. Back in the 1990s, we established the Inner City Social Housing Trust, which went on to create over 300 affordable housing units in multiple locations around our city. And I think that is looked back upon as one of the finest things achieved by the city during that decade. It was ultimately merged into the Housing Choices Australia some time afterwards, but the legacy of that work lives on to this day. But I think with the establishment of Homes Melbourne, which is what is proposed here in this motion tonight, I think this is going to take the City of Melbourne's efforts in this area to the next level, and I think it will stand as one of the most important things that we do in this term of office. And the truth is that Homes Melbourne is going to change lives. It is going to give more Melburnians the security and stability of a home in the world's most livable city. And what's more, Homes Melbourne is also going to help deliver a huge jobs boost for our city right when it's needed most. Homes Melbourne will work with Homes Victoria, community housing providers, support services and developers to ensure the new funding, the record $5.3 billion package, which has been announced by the Victorian Government, that is put to delivering the best possible outcomes in our city, and allow the City of Melbourne to do what it does so well in creating to bringing to life and revitalising our urban renewal precincts across our municipality, and ensuring that that Melbourne gets the right mix of new housing in the right locations while achieving the highest standards in design and sustainability. So I am extremely, extremely excited about this submission, and I am extremely excited by what the City of Melbourne is going to achieve through Homes Melbourne. I think this is going to be a game changer for the city, and I think we will look back upon this as one of the proudest things that we ever do.
Are there any other speakers to this motion? Councillor Lippitt.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. I completely agree with the Deputy Lord Mayor and also the mover, our portfolio lead. I'm going to get the portfolio wrong, but it certainly covers affordable housing and homelessness. Oh, my God, it's been a long night. And I just want to echo my thanks to the team for putting together a remarkable submission. Let's not underestimate the policy ambitions of the council, but also the state. $5.3 billion is a big number for the big housing build. While we get our heads around the size of that number, we're going to quickly realise that that's the number we're going to have to keep rolling on year in, year out, if we're going to keep delivering enough affordable homes to overcome the housing crisis that we're in. And of course, it's not just us who are spinning at the prospect of a number that large, but also the new entities that have been created to deliver the strategy that we're talking about today are busy figuring out how to partner or not with local government, where to target their efforts, where to build, where to commandeer existing buildings. And this intervention into this policy space is incredibly important. It's one of the most important things we're going to do as a council. I'd like to highlight, as Councillor Ball did, the need to refurbish what we have. The North Melbourne Housing Estate
will need a wholesale refurbishment in order to ensure that its operations are energy efficient and low cost and high quality for the public housing tenants of today and the future. We need more public housing. If the state government is serious about doing urban renewal properly, it can look at the hectares and hectares and hectares of state government-owned land it has in Arden and put at least 10% of it aside for public housing units. If it doesn't, it is not serious about how it does this. That the City of Melbourne is not a declared public, a declared priority area yet, and it should be, and that's obviously recommendation number one, it must be once this strategy's final version comes through. There's nowhere better than places like Arden with a brand new train station coming online by 2025 for the construction of new public housing units. Like everyone, I'm nervous about the future of central city living and what COVID and what climate and what other macro forces are doing to the centre of our city and what general affordability crises are doing to the centre of our city. There are new policy interventions that are advocated for here, such as the head lease provisions for state government to come in and induce occupancy in central city homes by becoming the head lessor and subleasing out to the market. Fascinating issue, massively complicated. I'm looking forward to delving into that issue more in months to come. My word of caution, I suppose, is this. We know that student housing accommodation in particular has been of lower quality than private market dwellings because of the way planning approvals work. And while some student housing in the municipality will definitely be appropriate for medium and longer term rentals, others won't. And whilst some inner city housing will be perfect for government becoming, leasing out and subleasing those properties, others may not. What we have to do is continue to ensure that the central city, which has a lot of vacancies at the moment, remains a destination, a market of choice and an attractive market for everyone, especially those on low incomes, and does not become the place that either the council or the state government says, here's where the normal standards of living can be waived in the interests of COVID or in the interests of economic recovery or in the interests of housing affordability. And I know that's not what this submission is saying, but it's certainly what I'm saying, that the central city is a marvellous place and we need to do some serious intervention into the market if we're going to induce that occupancy, but do it in a way that doesn't compromise on standards of accommodation in a way that sets a new precedent that inner city living is a different standard to what you'll find elsewhere. So these are incredibly complicated policy discussions to have, but we have to have them. It'll be it'll be a critical issue of this term of council. And so I do hope that we can forge a more constructive relationship with the state government, because as the state government gets its head around what its 10-year strategy is going to be and how it's going to unroll the big housing build, it will find that it will need to bring the local government sector and the property sector and people everywhere along with it, and planning from the top down and telling local government and others after the event what its plans are is not going to cut it. This is a whole of government, whole of society problem that needs to be tackled. And the message from the City of Melbourne, I'm sure, to the state government is we are absolutely in it to be constructive and as cooperative to meet what are exactly the same aims to tackle this housing crisis together.
Thank you, Councillor Leppett. Are there any other speakers to this motion? Councillor Hakim.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. I'd also like to, I agree with the speakers, with Councillor Ball. Thank you for bringing this motion, Deputy Lord Mayor, for championing this as well. And Homes Melbourne is about being side by side with the state government in rolling out what is an amazing a piece of work for affordable housing going forward. It's sort of the biggest investment in affordable housing in Victoria's history, and we need to take this chance to ensure that it's done in partnership across the board, as Councillor Leppard also said. I think diversity of housing is a critical part of an inclusive community, and something that I'm so proud to be part of, a council that is taking this bold step here as well in leadership around this space. Affordable housing in inner Melbourne, importantly, is critical for our community, for our economy, and to ensure that Melbourne continues to be the best place to live in the world. That diversity of the people who live here, work here, contribute to everything that we do, make up what Melbourne is. And we must be recognise that and remember that we have to create these spaces for people from across all landscapes. I'd like to also add my voice to commend officers on this policy. It is a terrific piece of work. There is so much to do out of this, and the actions have been suited for short, medium and long term as well, which is terrific. In a new economy, an economy and a community that recognises the gaps and the mishaps of the past, I think it's time for strong, equitable strategies that are actionable. And it's so great to see that in this. I'll be commending this motion. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Hakim. Any other speakers to this motion? Then I was going to add my comments, because we know housing and homelessness is absolutely a top priority for this council and for our city and for our people. And this is a moment in time. This submission really leverages the confluence of a long-suffered housing crisis with what we see now is a coalition of the willing, the able and now well-resourced group of organisations, absolutely led by the state government and its decision to properly fund a significant delivery of much-needed affordable and social housing. So in this moment of time, I am so appreciative and grateful to our team, led by Emma Appleton, supported by our CEO, Justin Hanney, our councillors who are involved in the relevant portfolios, our entire councillor group, and reflecting the ambitions of our constituents to pull together this submission. I acknowledge the expertise, the dedication and the absolute leadership of everyone involved pulling this submission together. I hope that's then reflected in the leadership of the actions of that coalition of the willing led by the state government, because this submission reflects our ability to create a game-changing, city-shaping, but most importantly, life-transforming set of policies and actions in the city of Melbourne for Melburnians. That's actually why we're here, is to make a positive impact and deliver outcomes for people that need it most. And this is what this submission represents. So thank you very much. And I absolutely positively think that the Homes Melbourne initiative is one of the best leadership positions we can take to make sure that we deliver as much as we possibly can in our municipality for those that need it most. So well done to everybody. I'm going to be so happy to put my hand up at the right time. And that time is now, because I'm putting this motion to the vote. All those who are in favour, please raise your hands. It's unanimous, and declare that motion carried. And well done, everybody. That's terrific. Thank you. This now brings us to item 6.5, which is Queen Victoria Market Precinct Renewal Food Court Concept Design. Councillors, would we like a presentation on this item? Were we planning that? No, we've had enough information to be able to consider this item this evening, so that's terrific. The motion as amended is on our screen, and before we come to that, I note that we have a couple of people who had requested the opportunity to present on this matter, and I'm hoping that you've managed to stay on the line. What are we, 2.5 hours into this meeting? So I'm looking to see if Vijay Sivaraj, Vijay, whether you are still with us.
Hi, Lord Mayor. Jordan here from Council Business. Vijay did not join us tonight.
He didn't. Okay, that's a shame, but thank you. And I'm wondering if Leah, if you are still with us.
Of course I'm still with you.
Good on you. Thank you, Leah. Over to you.
Okay, so I'm speaking on all three of these things, as there are many traders that are too scared to speak up and out, as they fear there may be ramifications if they do. A lot of traders are facing the fact of whether or not their leases are going to be renewed. They're too scared to say anything, because if they say something, they're scared they're going to be kicked out. If they don't say something, they don't know if they're going to be staying. This isn't just a wham, bam, thank you, ma'am thing for a lot of us. This is our livelihoods. These are our families. Anything that the City of Melbourne does and the management does to the market implicates everyone in the market, as I've previously said, with Queen Street. And it's not just the traders, it's also the customers. A lot of the customers have become our family as well. And then from what we can see and what some of the leaseholders have been told in the food court, there's actually going to be less seating. But one of the main requests from all these guys in the food court is that they want more seating. But from all the pictures that we see, there's going to be big chunks of space that are for cooking demonstrations or whatever else. All functions from what we presume is going to happen. Sorry, I've just lost my way. The other main concern, which was brought up earlier, is once all these renovations are over, and this is a fear held out through the whole of the market, will our rents become affordable? Will we be able to trade in the market still? Will it be a viable option for us? Or is it going to get to the point where the rents will be too high and it'll become a boutique market exactly like a shopping centre, which is not what a market is supposed to be? So my other question is, why don't you just put it all out on the table, stop wasting our time and our energy, and tell us your final plans and exactly what you want to do to us all? Because we're all sitting here twiddling our thumbs, pulling our hair out, losing night's sleep, having arguments with customers, with traders over what's actually going on and the management. We just need to know what you actually want to do to the place. Thank you.
Thank you, Leah. Thank you for presenting a number of times this evening, and we can definitely hear your passion and your concerns, so thank you. I don't think there are any other speakers for this moment, so thank you. I'm going to move this motion as it appears on the screen, and I am looking for a seconder to the motion. Councillor Campbell, thank you very much. This is our third Queen Victoria Market item this evening, and I really believe that it represents how we have an absolute major focus on this beloved asset within the City of Melbourne, and our commitment to future-proofing, to renewing, to creating a platform but also a pathway for a very bright future for this market, for the traders, for customers, for visitors, for future generations to feel that we are investing appropriately in an asset that has been going for more than 150 years, and we hope that this investment represents its ability to function well for all stakeholders in decades to come. I'm really pleased to move this particular motion tonight, which is about the food hall concept design. It will start a process to underpin the this part, this essential piece really of our market infrastructure, and bring it up to modern standards and make it a place that people want to trade in and dwell in and visit. I've listened tonight to all of the submitters and I've seen the faces of all of our councillors and know that we're concerned to continue representing to everybody who loves the market our dedication to this this special place. But in particular, listening to Leah, I think please know that we are very concerned about creating an environment for traders to flourish and to be successful and to be able to make long-term commitments and to feel confident about the future. I'm not aware of withholding any information about what the renewal plans are. And as it rolls out, of course, all of those plans are made publicly available for comment and response and to be involved. As we know, over many, many years, even before I was here, this has been an ongoing process, but there have been many times where different stakeholders have been able to contribute and also for us to keep reconfirming our commitment to the long-term future of this market. I think some of the more recent initiatives have also shown a commitment to our traders, such as support for the reductions in rent during the toughest trading period in our lifetimes, the commitment to initiatives to bring people to the market, such as the vouchers at Christmas time, and we will continue to show that ongoing commitment, working with the QVM management and other stakeholders to the market. Through the consultation that we've had across this renewal project and its various aspects, there's no doubt that the traders in the food court and in other parts of the market have told us that the 1990s rendition that is there at the moment is now outdated, that it does limit their potential to grow and limit their ability to do exciting things with their businesses. The concept designs that we've seen in the papers and that we're considering tonight do contain upgrades to the dining area, including more capacity for diners inside and outside, better shop fronts and facilities for traders as they operate more greenery and a much nicer environment, including new flooring, a new roof, and other essential safety measures that absolutely positively need to be done to make sure that this is a modern environment in which our traders can operate and our customers can enjoy. We are looking to include multi-purpose flexible spaces to ensure the future-proofing around the usage of this area. Plenty of room for traders, customers, but also for events and for whatever else may be thought of in the future to attract customers to this area and to make sure that it has that flexibility to drive other initiatives for visitation to the market. We've also discussed ways in which things like the night market can be incorporated into these areas to provide more capacity and have people moving around. We want to see our investment, of course, mean that it's about progress at the market. It's about supporting our traders, delivering improvements also for their staff, the amenity for customers, and, as I said, to know that this is about investing in the long-term future of the market. For all of those reasons, I'm happy to support and move this motion this evening. I acknowledge that as we go forward, not everybody can agree to all the details, but I really do hope, Leah, to you and other traders, that you can see the materialisation of our commitment to this market and to your future at the market. So for those reasons, I'm happy to move, and I'm calling now on Councillor Campbell as the seconder.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. And thank you, Leah. It's clear that, like so many of the decisions this council makes, there are going to be opposing views. But what I would like to say in seconding this motion is that we are really conscious of the difficulty that this change imposes on traders. And that's why, in respect of the food court specifically, there has been consultation with current food court traders, and their feedback has been incorporated into these designs. We know that there is a need from a safety perspective to address some of the issues with this food court, and this design certainly does that. But one of the reasons that I'm proud to second this motion is it turns the food court into a compelling reason to visit the market. We know that from the great markets around the world, I'm thinking of places like La Boqueria in Barcelona, a market shopping experience is so much more than a place that you duck in and out of to pick up a few essentials. It's a place that you can linger. It's a place where you can enjoy the produce you've purchased. It's a place that you can turn it from shopping into a place to spend a day. And by enhancing experiences such as the food hall, we are providing the ability for shoppers to do that. Experiences such as this are what distinguishes the market from doing your supermarket shop, from going to a smaller market. It provides a vibrant reason to spend time in the market, to linger, and we know that the benefit of that is that shoppers who linger for longer are more likely to spend more. We know there's a clear, tangible benefit for our traders if that's the shopping experience they're having. For those reasons, I'm really proud to second this motion.
Thank you, Councillor Campbell. Are there any other speakers to this motion, Councillor Lippitt?
Thank you, Lord Mayor. Completely agree with what you and Councillor Campbell have said, and I'm happy to support this motion as well. I want to thank, I'm assuming it's BSPN Architecture, whose logo is on the drawings, who have done this work for us to bring such a high-quality proposal for our consideration. There's a lot of detail here for signing off on a concept plan, which is essentially what we're doing tonight, with a little tweak here, of course. But you can see through the resolution that's proposed here that Council is giving a strong in principle support, and any tweaks to those designs can happen to the satisfaction of management, so under delegation. The head of power here is relatively strong. I would like to thank all of the work that's gone into bringing this to us. There's always going to be lots of opinions on how to use a space, and now is the time to have that discussion. We've heard from Leah today and others about just what this space is going to be used for. I quite like the pivot from food court to food hall. I like that the furniture isn't fastened to the ground and it's like any other food court. I think you need a little bit of flexibility and multifunctional uses here, but we hear loud and clear that this is a food court and the aim of the game is to fit lots of people in here on market days so that we can get as many customers through enjoying the many offerings of the market as possible. No one's under any illusions as to what the core purpose of the new food hall here is. And so subject to these tweaks, I think we're looking at the potential for an incredibly high quality proposal here. The last thing I just want to briefly say is that one of the main reasons we're doing this is because of what the people panel asked us to do. And thank you, Leah. You're a member of the People's Panel. So even though you're asking us tonight not to go ahead until we look at the entire picture, I can't help myself but go back to what you have asked us to do as a member of the People's Panel through Recommendation 6, which is to improve infrastructure and amenities at the food court, which involves upgrading the toilets in the food court, include air conditioning, and then it goes on to say the food court caters for over 10,000 people a week, used by the public as a break in between shopping, school groups, tourists purchasing seafood from the fish section and eating in the food court. It seats over 500 people at a time. It's in definite need of refurbishment. We heard
overwhelming feedback from our People's Panel, and thank you to all of our People's Panel members who put in all of their time to tell us what they want. We are now delivering on exactly what you've asked for, and may it go forward.
Thanks, Councillor Lippitt. Are there other speakers to this motion? Then I'm going to put the motion to the vote. All those in favour, please raise your hands. It's unanimous. I declare the motion carried. Thank you, councillors, and to everyone who participated. We're up to agenda item 6.7, support and pilot project for return of international students. Would councillors like a presentation on this item? Councillor Lulu?
I was going to ask a question to Andrew Weir. Andrew just more wanted to get an idea of what the current market is in terms of what our competitors are doing in the UK, Canada and US, given our current situation with the returning of no returning international students at the moment, if you have any data. Yep.
Sure. Thank you, Councillor. The feedback that we've been receiving from the universities in Melbourne has been that students that are currently enrolled and set to start in Australia are currently changing their mind and seeking an on-campus experience. Increasingly, they're turning to Canada and the UK as options, as destinations. The United Kingdom in the current academic year has seen a 9% increase in the number of enrolments of international students from non-European Union countries. In October this year, the UK introduced a two-year post-study work visa, which enables students to stay on for 2 years after they've finished their degree, or 3 years in the case of a PhD. And the key signal that the UK is trying to send is that the UK is open for business and that they want to attract the world's best and brightest talent. Last year, a global education provider called Navitas surveyed 400 international education agents in 63 countries. They did two surveys, one in May and one in September during the pandemic. And what they found was a transformation in sentiment between May and September. Increasingly, the openness and the ability to access the study destination was the overriding concern of students. And that survey found that 71% of agents agreed that the UK had improved its reputation for being an open and welcoming to international students. But the corresponding figure for Australia was less than 50%, and 24% of agents disagreed with the proposition altogether. That survey was done in September, where we can assume that since September, that's that direction would only have amplified, that openness and the ability to access the study destination being the principal concern of students. And so I guess the principal concern running through that is our global competitive position is increasingly diminished, and with time we run the risk of enduring damage to our brand as a welcoming student city.
Thanks, Andrew. Very sobering stats. Thanks for the question, Councillor Leleu. I'm calling on a councillor to move the motion that appears on the screen. Thank you, Councillor Griffiths, and a councillor to second the motion. Councillor Lou, thank you. Over to you, Councillor Griffiths.
Thank you, Lord Mayor, and I was going to commence by obviously thanking all of the council officers for the large amount of work that they've done and in a short amount of time in relation to this issue. And I think in that brief presentation we had there from Andrew Weir, we get an impression of just how large a body of work this is when we're dealing with large global trends in a massive market. It's something which is both important and difficult for local government to get their heads around, and perhaps that just adds so much to why it is that we're calling on the Victorian and federal governments to help support the work that needs to be done in regards to this issue. It's a massive amount of work, and so thanks again to everyone who's been doing it so far. Obviously, tonight I want to talk about why the return of international students is so important, but before getting on to that topic, I do want to emphasise that public health and safety have been the starting point in all of our considerations, and the City of Melbourne won't be advocating now and won't be in the future for a second-rate quarantine system or anything that would risk public health and, by extension, the economy of our city and our state. So I think it's important to say that right from the very outset. I could speak for hours. I think people know on the benefits that international students bring to our city. Rest assured that I'm conscious of how many hours people have spent here today, and I'll do my best to be brief. But there are a number of important points to make. The lens that's usually applied to consideration of international students is an economic one, and that obviously is understandable, where in our city there are so many institutions that rely on international students to be viable. These institutions and organisations that employ Melburnians resource themselves from other businesses and so on through an economic web that is so intrinsic to the life of our city. And international students, of course, are both potential customers and employees of a much broader range of sectors of our economy than just the education one. So I feel that the economic case really speaks for itself. I've never really heard anyone argue against the notion of the economic importance of international students to our city. But as we've said many times, and it's certainly worth reiterating, we know that international students bring far, far more to the city than just that economic impact. I was reading through the background information for this and noting that international students make up to 39% of the residents of some of our suburbs. And obviously enough, you know, that means that they're the neighbours in our streets, they're the volunteers in our community organisations, they're the people who teach us as Melburnians as much about the world as they are here to be educated by us. And in the best instances, they become Melburnians who then travel the globe as ambassadors for our city, and that really leaves a legacy through their years here that gives for decades and decades and decades after. COVID, we know, has been the most disruptive single event that's occurred in our lifetimes, and I guess for that reason, when considering how many things state and federal governments have needed to address, it's not surprising that the return of international students wasn't the very first of those, wasn't at the forefront. But I think that it is at the forefront of issues that are being considered now. Not only do those businesses and educational institutions need to know that there's a roadmap forward for the future, but the 200,000 individual international students who normally call Melbourne home also need to know that we want them back and that we have a plan to get them back. As I said earlier on, designing that plan is a complex and time-consuming piece of work. It's unquestionably one that would be best done with all levels of government being involved, and I really hope that that's what will happen. But I think in this motion that we're making very clear that if not all levels of government feel able to make that commitment, then the City of Melbourne will continue to show leadership and will continue to work to ensure that that a plan is brought together to return international students to our city. To emphasise the importance of the second parts of the motion that we have here, and I'd like to thank again Councillor Le Liu for his work on these areas and his advocacy for ensuring that when international students do return, or for that matter the ones who've stayed here throughout COVID, that they experience the very best that Melbourne has to offer, that they get access to the kinds of experiences that are intrinsic to being a Melburnian. Whether that's going to the NGV, going to the footy or the Fringe Festival, here's probably the point where I could go on and on. I won't. But let me just note that, you know, there are so many organisations that I think are keen to be part of welcoming students to the City of Melbourne, and I want to encourage them to do so. Perhaps in concluding, I could just note that doing those sorts of things and bringing those partnerships together, we want international students to live their best lives in our city, but also note that we know that we need international students in our community for our city to lead its best life too. So thanks again to everyone who's done work to bring us to this point, and thanks in advance for the enormous amount of work, the enormous number of conversations that are going to need to happen from here.
Thank you, Councillor Griffiths. I'm going to you now, Councillor Lelou.
Thank you, Lord Mayor, and I just want to echo the sentiment and just say thank you to Andrew and the team and all everyone who's been working on this. It's a very critical issue, and I also want to pay my thanks to Councillor Griffith for his role in really taking, you know, as a new councillor taking on this. It's great. It's amazing to kind of the work that we've, I think we did, and the discussions we've had, and I'd say I'm looking really forward to working with you, you know, to put more more focus and more empowerment in this area, because it's really crucial. I think I'll just speak to very much the second point, 17.2, and look, the timing is that we need to do it now, because there will, you know, most likely there will be a federal and state election next year, and most likely no one's really going to be touching this issue, because politic-wise it's very hard. And I think right now for us, especially semester two, it's about to begin in July, late July, we need to really get on top of it. And that's why, but at the moment, I think, you know, there's a real impasse between state and federal government. And that's why I think it's crucial that we be seen to step in there. And for me, one of the key reasons, and thank you to indulge to my fellow councillors and Councillor Griffith for this, but, you know, for me, one of the key things, you know, talking about it is, if the state and the federal government is not willing to step up to the plate, then I think City of Melbourne will be able to step up. And I think that is so crucial, because we as a city get so much out of it. And I think this is the least we can do to fight up a good fight and to really hold the state and federal government accountable. 17.2.1, again, you know, there are a lot of students with expertise that we could use to fight the COVID, you know, and also there's a real shortage in the economic sense, that where jobs or skill set are needed, and I think a lot of students can actually help fill that. So helping prioritise those some of those students coming back here would be a great help. There's been a lot of negativity around the fact that, well, you know, do we put back an international student or do we put back a returning Australian? And I think this very equivalently calls out is we're not really calling for, you know, taking a spot of returning Australian. Rather, we're just saying, there's a spot for everyone, and I think, you know, how we actually do that, I think it can easily be done. And I think also the last point is how we actually do it. We can easily, I think, you know, setting up shop anywhere outside of City of Melbourne, I don't think will work. I think City of Melbourne is, and accommodation-wise, and the transport, chartered transport to Melbourne, I think it's the best way forward. And again, to Councillor Griffith's point, I wouldn't want a second-rate quarantine program because that would damage our brand. So we need to really get this properly and really done. And I guess to the second point, you know, this again shows, you know, our shout voucher, which in collaboration with the state government, who really did come to step up to the plate to help us and give us a lot of the money to help us feed a lot of the international students. This is the second kind of support package that we are going to do for this international students. So, you know, we do have a plan. We are willing to support more ongoing onshore international students here to ensure that they feel don't left out, because a lot of the debate is saying, well, we're bringing international students back, but we don't. What about the students that are already here? There are tens and thousands of them, as we've seen with the Outshout program. And I think we really do need to look after them, because it is also our priority, because they will be our ambassadors and they will be potentially future citizens of Melbourne and Australia. So, look, overall, thank you for indulging on this. And I guess, you know, I'm very excited to see how we can shift the movement or the discussion. And if not, you know, how we can step up to the plate and actually implement a pilot program, because that will be so crucially important in this time of need.
Thank you, Councillor Lowe. Are there any other speakers to this motion? again, I just think international students are a top priority for us. We've got a lot of top priorities, but having some key ones is important, and certainly a group that often miss out on appropriate attention and investment and support from other stakeholders. And so us playing a role here is important, as it has been. And thank you to Councillor Griffiths, Councillor Lalu and the team for constantly thinking about this and ways in which we can make a difference. I appreciate it. I'm looking forward to supporting it. I'm putting the motion to the vote. All those in favour, please raise your hands. It's unanimous, so we declare that motion carried. Thanks, councillors. Well, this concludes reports from management to be considered in open session this evening. There are no items of general business to be considered. I did run out of time in question time earlier to finish the questions that had been received. Before I do that, I do need to ask one other question. Are there any items of urgent business? None. Thank you. So that means that of the six questions received, we got to five of them. The last one is a written question from Chris Thrum, who says, Melbourne is the music capital of Australia. The density levels set for non-seated venues at present is 75%. The music industry is asking for levels to be lifted to those that are the same as other venues, seated venues, and that's 100%. Is this a reasonable request? Your thoughts? And Andrew Weir, our Director of Economic Development and International, has responded and said, Melbourne has more live music venues per capita than any city in the world. However, with restrictions on trade, ongoing venue density limits and reduced visitor numbers, COVID-19 has hit the music industry hard. While JobKeeper has ended, non-seated areas are still limited to one person per 2 square metres, and many venues are reporting that that in this context, live music is not sustainable or profitable. We hope that the Victorian and Australian governments can work with the music industry to find a solution that enables venues to operate both profitably and safely, and the City of Melbourne will continue to be champions for an industry that differentiates us, that delivers so much value, and of course we'll continue to review the things that are within our power that can make a difference to supporting that very important sector. And Chris Thrum, you are a participant in that sector, so thank you very much for what you do and for your interest and advocacy for that sector. Thank you. That's it for question time at the end of our Future Melbourne Committee meeting. Thank you to the members of the public for your interest, to all of our management team and councillors and the team that helps pull all this together every week. Thank you for your preparation and hard work, and I'm declaring the meeting closed at 8:41 p.m. Thank you very much.